Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 127 of Through the Years, the podcast that reviews Ring of Honor show by show from the beginning. My name is Trevor Dame, joined as always by the co-architect of this building. No take twos. We're like Ring of Honor, Matt Feuerstein. And joining us, doing a little carpentry today, we've been on his show. Both of us individually, Matt, have been on this gentleman's show, but he is making his first appearance on Through the Years. You might know him as being the T in the Q&T podcast that both Matt and I have been guests on. You might know him from his non-wrestling themed podcast, Heat Death of the Universe, Tim Buckner. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. For this evening, I would appreciate if I could be referred to as the Juicy Timbit.
Fantastic. This is the shortest episode. We're done now.
No, wait, don't talk to the Juicy Timbit like that. That's very rude, Trevor.
Thank you.
Ugh. Matt.
But yeah, unfortunately, you guys may have messed up because I don't know if you understand this, but I'm a day one scar baby. I'm a deep vein thrombozo. I was counting in anticipation for every time the J Driller was kicked out of, and I was, you know, being upset every time there was man on woman violence. And I have not only had a good time, but I have always had a great time, and I really appreciate being here tonight.
The J Driller count that was aborted, that is like the deepest of cuts. That is like a real shibboleth for this show, if you know that.
Well, that was the deep cut that caused the scar baby.
There's, you know, Tim's a great guy and has two great podcasts, but I would say the worst thing about him is his longtime fandom of our podcast. So
that's fair.
Yeah.
What I did do is I was trying to do the research. Oh, go ahead. I told Trevor, I was like, I'm going to figure out, because I had the theory, the working theory for a long time, that have a good time, have a great time came from a Sal Renaro promo originally. So I went back and I listened from the beginning to find if I could find where it came from. And I will say I did not. You just randomly said it on the 35th episode and that was it. It just stuck. So it was not actually from a promo like I thought.
Yeah, I've told the story before, but it literally comes, I believe it was an episode with Joe Gagne. And as I've always done, I've had a difficult time with consistent sign-ons and sign-offs. It took me a long time. I was just fumbling towards something that felt right. And so one episode, I decided to go, until next time, have a good time. And no one talked, and it didn't feel like enough. And then there was a pause, and then I said, have a great time. And then I'm sure Matt cut this off, but Joe and Matt immediately laughed at me and I was immediately embarrassed. And Matt then said, you have to do that for every single episode now. And when Matt says that, I unfortunately then have to do it for every single episode. So that has become, maybe someone has said that. That sounds like a very Sal Renaro thing, but that was literally an example of why I usually stick to writing and not podcasting other than this show, because I don't think very quickly. And if I start an idea halfway through, there is no guarantee I will be able to finish it in a satisfactory way.
Trevor just sticks to writing and not podcasting, except for this show, also known as his podcast, and also all of the other podcasts that he sometimes is on.
That is people's mistakes to invite me. So, any podcast that invites me, horrible podcast, listen to Q&T.
That's one of the podcasts that invites you.
Yes.
On my journey of going through everything, I did think about it today, and I was like, I should have taken notes for more stuff that I wanted to reference. So then I was like, let me check this. So I did do screen recordings of different things that I guess I thought were important in the moment that I found. And I was like, let me check out what these screen recordings are. And just to prove how much of a egotistical dumbass I am, one of the screen recordings was just Trevor shouting out my old podcast, This Week in Wrestling. So for some reason in the moment, I was like, I want to save this. I want to definitely hear Trevor saying that we're good. Another one is Trevor saying that Gabe Sapolsky is smarter than him. I just wanted to save that. And then the last one that I had saved was Matt in 2018 talking about a E. coli breakout that was happening in romaine lettuce and predicting that by 2024, we would be in a hellscape post-apocalyptic world based off of some kind of pandemic, global pandemic that had happened, which you were almost right there, Matt. You were like so close.
Wait. Okay, so wait. What did I say? What episode was this?
Okay. So I'll have to pull that up. And this might take me a second, but it was in 2018, and you were talking about.
I think there were multiple episodes where we predicted pandemics. Yeah. Like multiple.
Sure,
episodes.
Sure. But you were talking about this was Night of the Grudges, episode 20.
Okay.
It was actually on 4/20 of 2018, so, you know, chief it. And you were talking about getting that good green, and by that good green on 4/20, you were talking about E. coli-laced romaine lettuce.
Okay.
And you mentioned that by the year 2024, yeah, by the year 2024, we would all be in a post-apocalyptic hellscape because of some kind of a pandemic that would break out and kill everyone.
Well, you know, I got to now find that and send it to all of my friends just to prove that I am the messenger of doom, which is what I've always wanted people to think of me as, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So.
You know what? I do want to give Matt – I do think you are a seer in many ways, but also – I think we've made some easy predictions, but you know what? I'm going to try and top you, Matt. I'm going to say right now, through the year's prediction, 2029, there will be strife in the Middle East. Call it now. I'm calling it now. If in 5 years, when we're probably a quarter of the way through 2007 Ring of Honor, if that's true, just I want some compliments. But
I feel like if it's not true, you should get compliments too, because you'd like the fact that like you – kind of foresaw it means that the opposite will happen, meaning for the first time in our lifetimes, yes, there will not be strife in the Middle East. And I feel like you would deserve credit for that too. Trevor Dame, bring peace to the world.
I will just say this has been one of our better intros because rare is it that we have a guest that really boosts our egos, and dear God, do our egos need boosting. So Tim, sure, thank you so much for having on. I'm sure we will have a great time as we cover Dethrone, today's episode, which took place November 25th, 2006, at the Inman Sports Club in Edison, New Jersey.
I believe it's Inman, but I like the idea of Inman. Inman.
Oh, Inman. I've never been to a Ring of Honor show.
It's Irie Island vibes. It's Inman.
Yes. So either way, it was in Edison, New Jersey. Happened in front of 700 fans. And we open with – this was something. We open with Samoa Joe, Homicide, and Julius Smokes backstage. Smokes calls the Briscoes the Duke Boys, says they're in trouble, says they're going to fry the Briscoes like Crisco. He calls Homicide the Puerto Rican Assassin, and he calls Samoa Joe in yet another example of how Through the Years syncs up with modern wrestling things, Mighty Joe Young. And Matt, I don't know if you're not as deep in the horrible wrestling minutia and gossip as a scumbag like I am, but there was a kerfluffle for people that are listening to this episode on the way far Arfong future. Between the last episode of Through the Years and this one, there was a bit of a thing where Jim Cornette posted a clip of his podcast where he talked about Swerve Strickland, and as Jim Cornette's podcast has, it has a wacky drawing of something he talked about, and it has a picture of Swerve Strickland and then a drawing of Jim Cornette as a giant gorilla. And Jim Cornette's defense –
don't forget Q-tip.
And a Q-tip. And his defense was, it's me referencing Mighty Joe Young, because that's something apparently Jim Cornette does. And it was then weird to see Smokes make that reference. And then it led to a big debate online of, is Jim Cornette racist because of that comment or not? And I'll just solve the debate right now. Jim Cornette is not racist because of this. He is racist because of his long history of other racist comments. So this would just be running up the score. You know, he's racist because he called Mark Madden's mom up and said the N-word to her. He's racist because of his long history of comments about Muslims and Asian women. And, you know, this would be the cherry on top. So we can just avoid this debate. But anyway, sidetrack for that.
But also this promo was funny for several other reasons.
Yes, because we then get Joe saying it's going to – Samoa Joe then says, it's going to be a rough night, boys. And he goes, I hope you're ready to man up, bitches. And he makes a jack-off hand motion as he says man up. And I wrote in my notes, is that what we should call masturbating now? Did Joe stumble on something here? Should we call masturbating manning up? Because I could never do the way the Briscoes refer to man up, being a tough man that gets into fights, but I could man up that way. I have man up that way, but
you have. This is outrageous.
I can confirm at least one instance in my
life. Right. You've spilled your seed.
Episode's over. I'm out of here. Yeah, I'm not. I don't feel comfortable being on a podcast with someone who's done that.
What I like, Joe was cracking up when Smokes was going on about the Duke boys. And the other thing is, I mean, I guess you haven't finished the recap yet, so yeah. I won't step on your toes. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just end with just one little bit here. Homicide says the Briscoes have been hanging with Borat too much because they've been hanging out with their cousins too much. And Matt, I think
that's
I know
what
you're
saying. That's not what he said.
He's been fucking.
He said they've been fucking, yes.
And then I wrote in my notes, Matt, and this may be what you're referring to. This is, again, talk about a cut for recent listeners of 3 years. I wrote in my notes, Matt, did they go see Borat with Albert and Matt?
Yes, because, real deep vein thrombozos who have been listening recently know that the one saving grace of Albert Ching's weekend visiting me and going to see the bitter end, one of the most depressing ROH shows of all time, was that we did see Borat on opening weekend. And enjoyed it very much, and obviously Homicide did too. So that was nice as well.
Yes. Well, okay, but here's the even another full circle that's maybe more relatable for people who are not as deep veined thrombosos as myself. Borat 2 included the scene with disgraced former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, who famously married his cousin.
Oh my goodness.
So Homicide is not only like referencing the film, but he's also referencing something that's going to happen in the future. But I guess concurrently, probably Giuliani was married to his cousin at the time of recording.
It's just cousins on top of cousins on top of cousins.
What is this? The bloodline?
Okay. We got
Trevor. Trevor, we've already gone over the fact that we don't like that you've masturbated, and now you keep talking about your fetish for cousins on top of cousins on top of cousins. I don't want to hear it. We're past this.
So we didn't go to two dark matches. I could say some things I won't, but we have a dark tag team match. Pele Primo and Rhett Titus teamed up to defeat Alex Payne and Grim Reefer. Boy, that's a guy who had not been on a Ring of Honor show in a long while, in more than a blue moon, Matt. And then we have another dark match. Jagged defeated Mitch Franklin. Matt, do you remember who Jagged ended up becoming? He's still in wrestling.
100% no.
It is the future Angelo Parker.
Proud papa to be. Yeah, Angelo Parker.
Yeah. I'm going to assume, because Jagged had never worked a Ring of Honor show before, that being that he's Canadian and El Generico, this was his first show in Ring of Honor in like well over a year, that they probably made the trip up together. That would be my guess. Because I thought, why Jagged out of nowhere when he's not like getting future shots? But maybe it was one of those classic, hey, if you're booking me, can I bring a friend? Can he get some work? And hey, why not?
That absolutely makes sense too, because they're both French-Canadian, which yeah. I think. Trevor, you'll appreciate this. Recently on the other podcast, I had to admit that I got myself confused, and this is not like a short-term confusion. My entire life, I had mixed up the province of Quebec, I guess. Or is Quebec a province?
It's a province.
Quebec is a province.
Okay.
There is also a Quebec city in Quebec, which is what maybe might get confusing.
I had always confused where physically, geographically speaking, where Quebec is with where Alberta is. So my entire life, I had always thought that those two were flopped. So I thought Quebec was more on the East Coast.
You mean on the West Coast, you mean?
Yeah.
That is highly offensive, especially because I, Trevor Dame, was born in Alberta, like so many great wrestlers. But I quickly got the fuck out of there, like so many great Canadians. Alberta is. So we move on to the opening match, the match that started the DVD proper. Brent Albright defeated El Generico via submission in 6 minutes, 40 seconds when he made him tap up to the crowbar. So as I said earlier, this was El Generico's first match in Ring of Honor in nearly 15 months. So, you know, this was the start, you know, it's them putting the toe in the water for him finally becoming a full-timer, although this would not happen for a while. Matt, what'd you think about this?
It was just like, okay, so first of all, one of these guys seemed like they could potentially be one of the biggest draws during one of the hottest periods in WWE history. But which one could it be? Probably not the one that Gabe thought. there was a lot of cognitive dissonance for me, like watching this and being like, oh, I mean, I guess this is a okay, not quite squash, but like enhancement match for Brent Albright. But like the whole time thinking like, this is fucking El Generico that he's doing this with. Like, and El Generico is the one who's in the Jobber to the Stars role. And the crazy part of it is, like, this isn't early El Generico. This is late 2006 El Generico, already easily one of the best wrestlers in North America. And it just makes me, like, it just makes me so confused about sometimes Gabe's parameters and standards. Like, obviously he ended up pushing El Generico. And by Final Battle, he was in a little bit more of a featured position. But it's like, would El Generico have ever gotten a real push in ROH if it wasn't for him and Kevin Steen teaming up? I don't know. And obviously, El Generico is not over with this crowd as a star in any way. You know, the crowd doesn't really react to any of his signature spots or anything like that. Albright gets more of a chant than El Generico. In fact, it's a very like Jersey, like Albright chant, which I always enjoy hearing that accent. Except in real life, I don't enjoy it. Generico gets a little bit of offense. It's not like it's the matches from the night before where Albright's just squashing everybody. But he still does the thing where he suckers Generico in with a handshake, suplexes him on his head, Generico gets a couple of moves. Albright quickly comes back with the German half Nelson suplex combo in the crowbar. Just basic finish. Really pretty disappointing considering who was in it. No heat, some awkwardness. Just not much to it. And like, it's just, I just could not stop thinking about how insane it was that this is the role that El Generico was brought back to do. It's just crazy. Like, it's so weird how this ended up. Again, this wasn't like beginning of career El Generico. That's what makes it crazier. Like, if this was just a guy getting started, I would kind of understand it, but this is El Generico once he's been established in some ways, and they decided to just serve him up to Brent Albright here. It's very weird.
And Tim, I mean, I know this, when you were thinking about when we got you on the show, I know one of your dreams was probably, I am finally on a podcast going to get to review a Brent Albright match. Well, your dream right now, your ship has come in. What did you think about this?
Okay, you would think that that is the case, but I actually have reviewed a Brent Albright match before on a podcast.
Oh, my God.
CM Punk versus Brent Albright from OVW. I guess Gunnar Scott. I have actually reviewed that one of those matches before on a podcast.
He was Brent Albright in OVW, wasn't he? And then he was Gunnar Scott when they brought him up.
Now I was trying to even remember if he ever got brought up. I think you're right, actually. He was.
I can look it up. You guys.
Yeah, he was brought up to SmackDown briefly as Chris Benoit's protege.
Yes. He was Brent Albright. So I did technically, I have reviewed a Brent Albright match before on a podcast, but on a prestigious podcast like this, no, of course. yeah, it's odd because there's matches later on this show, and in general, there's like some things that happen on this show that I kind of like, I feel like a little bit of my West Coast PWG versus ROH biased kind of shows in the way that I would think about something before, you know, rewatching the matches here. And this would be a match where I guess I would have thought that as well, because at this point, as you said, like El Generico is already like established in PWG as one of the best wrestlers in the world. unrelated to any of this, I was looking through, I was actually trying to find a specific quote from Kenny Omega on a shoot interview where he was talking about how he was going to go to New Japan, but he wasn't going to do the typical foreigner who's a heel and joins the Bullet Club. And then obviously that's exactly what he did, because people were talking about how Kenny Omega is, you know, like whatever, like basically just how great of a worker Kenny Omega really is and that it gets overlooked. But what I did come across while looking for that was him talking about DDT asking him for who should we bring over? Who's a good guy that can like fit the perfect spots here? And he explained how like a small company like DDT, they can't afford to just bring over anybody. They have to bring over someone who's going to be worthwhile. And the first person that popped in his head was Generico as a guy who could do everything and will deliver 100% across the board. And that is basically a couple of years after this, theoretically. That said, I mean, the match itself, if you just watch this in a bubble, I don't necessarily know that you see that, because I kind of came across this thinking like, you know, again, just turning my brain off and watching it here, I'm like, this is not the peak, one of the greatest baby faces who ever wrestled El Generico. Like, but that also has to do with the crowd is not super invested. The crowd's not like into it. His stuff looks good. He does some neat little character stuff that's kind of goofy. Brent Albright, I thought, looked good at times. I've always been more of a fan of Brent Albright than I think other people. I thought the finish was pretty sick. I thought that like the actual sequence of suplexes and then the crowbar looked good. And it made sense as the finish. The highlight of it obviously was Generico just taking like big boy bumps on the top of his head. But yeah, it was just tough. Part of it was tough was just that the crowd was not there. And I did want to ask, and it's a good enough place to do it. Matt, I know you were at the previous night's show, but were you at this show?
Yes, I was.
Okay, so you were part of this terrible crowd.
Yes. I mean, any crowd I'm in is at least a little terrible. But yes, I was there, and I remember just thinking it was like an epidemic at this point in ROH that these crowds were bad. Like, I actually thought that in some ways this one was a little better than some of the ones I had been at recently and on some of the DVDs. Like, still very bad, but like, it just like, I don't know, something wasn't clicking with these crowds at this moment. It really didn't. You know, it was really refreshing when we got to Final Battle and I was actually in a hot crowd for once. And then, you know, once things got going in 2007, the crowds got more into it again. This was just a cold period, man. It was just a very cold period.
Sure, sure. But Trevor, do you have any thoughts on the match?
I do.
Sorry, I'm used to hosting podcasts.
No, that absolutely. This was Generico's. I just got shocked that I was being thrown to. I was like, oh, look at my notes. I would have been really bummed watching this match if I did not know the future and know that Generico solidifies himself in Ring of Honor and has a nice little run there, because yeah, it, like Matt, like you were saying, it's kind of depressing to see that he didn't get, you know, he had mixed results on his first run where he didn't look his best, kind of to what Tim was saying about this match. You know, some of his, you know, matches, you know, wasn't great at that point, but he also wasn't put in a lot of positions to succeed always. And it's the same here. It's like, why bring him back and immediately throw him into, like, he's not going to win anyone over in a 6-minute largely squash match for Brent Albright. But I actually probably enjoyed this a bit more as a match than you guys. I enjoyed it as a squash. Like, Generico played on the size difference early, like almost to the level of comedy, where he's gullible enough to accept that mid-match handshake that turns out to be a suplex. He's calling for the test of strength, even though he's clearly so outgunned, no pun intended, with the strength. And I actually clipped that and put that on Twitter because I thought Generico sold the fuck out of a 50-second test of strength. Like, he's crying, he's moaning, he's eventually working out. And it was a reminder that, you know, Generico was one of the great guys. And I love when guys with masks do this. You kind of have to do this, like, learn to almost overcompensate for covering part of their face with like being almost over the top with your expressiveness and your voice and your body language.
He was the master at like reaching out his arms for effect.
Yeah. I mean, I think we talked about years ago when Liger came in for a double shot. Like, again, Liger's another guy where I always point out, like, if you wrestle under a mask, like, study a guy like Liger too, where he doesn't have facial expressions, but he uses his body language so much, it's almost as if he does have facial expressions. And I think if you're a mask guy, you really have to turn everything up on that. Anyway, I would just say here, like Brent Albright, I mean, again, he's fine. Like, he's a dude where in a 6-minute squash match, he still takes it down to the mat with a chin lock at least once, I think twice. But he's also a big dude who, like, looks imposing. He can hit huge suplexes. El Generico gets to hit, like, 3 big moves, his tornado DDT, his Aluva kick, you know, back there just be the running Yakuza kick, you know, his really nice jumping crossbody. So overall, I'll say a couple things to finish up here. First thing I would say is, if people are wondering, like, where's Kevin Steen? Because he was always Generico's running buddy, was hand in hand with him, you know, on their first ROH run. Steen was actually in the middle of his one ever tour of Dragon Gate. He went on like a nearly 2-month tour of Dragon Gate that Generico was not invited on. And so he's right there. So I wonder if he would have been here if not for that. And the other thing is, you guys mentioned, Matt, you especially mentioned, like, Generico was already really getting a name elsewhere. Like, why would Gabe, like, not give him a big opportunity here? Doing research for, like, this period of shows lately, I read an interview, I believe, I don't have notes for it, but, like, that Gabe did around this time period. And one of the things he talked about was he had gotten to the point now where, as opposed to, like, the early days when they were starting Ring of Honor, where, like, he was so busy that he wasn't really watching many of the tapes wrestlers sent in anymore. And basically he was saying, like, most of the people that get into Ring of Honor now are just based on wrestlers on the roster recommending things to me. So, you know, I'm wondering, you know, would Gabe have even known that Generico was getting hot? Or is it a matter of just people on the roster were saying enough to him for a guy like Generico, like, no, he's really good. You should give him another look. And then him going, well, I'll treat him like I treat a lot of guys. I'll put him in a 6-minute squash match.
Well, okay, so you remember that Gabe was in some ways always active on the message board. And the message board definitely let him know who they wanted to see and who was making waves. And El Generico was always among the people, like, when those, that period when he wasn't there, where they were like, bring him back, give him a chance. You know, obviously Chris Hero was like the big example of somebody that people were begging for. But I mean, Brent Albright was someone that people wanted to see there too. But I have to think that Gabe saw El Generico's name enough times on the message board during that year to know that people thought he was awesome.
Well, it's an interesting thing because he's not going to get booked again for now for another 3 shows. He's going to miss the next 3 shows. Then he's going to be booked in like a random 4-way for Final Battle. Then he's going to miss another, I think, 3 shows. And then they're finally going to give him and Steen like the chance they always needed, which is like giving them a tag match against the Briscoes. And I believe like Gabe's instructions are just like, I have no notes, go out there and just try and steal the show. And so it's weird. Like, again, he's, you know, I would be a lot more outraged about this match if I didn't know that that's coming for him, you know. But
yeah. And I'm not outraged. It just feels weird to watch. It's just like this is crazy.
Oh, last note before I throw it to the next match. Brent Albright, I can confirm, I looked up on Cage Match, he was Brent Albright in OVW, even though you guys pretty much confirmed, like, you had remembered that. But I did find out his name before Brent Albright, Vinnie Valentino, which is just another in the pantheon of great fake Italian, like, wrestling guys. Hey, it's Vinnie Valentino over here, but that's my great Italian.
Yeah, well, looking through that history, I did find that, like, and I assume it was probably connected because there was always, like, a bit of a relationship, especially at that time, between WWE and APW, because Brent Albright was like a Oklahoma guy, I think it was, but he, for some reason, he goes through a run in APW, which may have been related to a WWE tryout thing. They had their eye on him. They sent him there. And so they had Vinny Valentino, and one of his first matches, and it seemed like a couple of his matches in APW, was against Vinny Marcello, right? Who still wrestles to this day. So they had Vinny versus Vinny doing the bad Italian names.
Brent Albright actually had a 2003 tour of Pro Wrestling NOAH as Vinny Valentino. Vinny Valentino wrestled Mitsuharu Misawa in tag matches. So in 2003, Ooh. That's kind of crazy. But anyway, so that brings us to our second match. For the top of the class trophy, and my notes It's freaked out. Shane Hagedorn defeated Bobby Dempsey to retain the trophy via pinfall in 2 minutes, 15 seconds after hitting him with a pair of brass knuckles. If you're wondering why for a second I kind of paused during the review, we got a rare AIM message. We normally don't talk on AIM, which is perfectly fine for people to do so, by the way. But we normally don't trade like text messages while we do the podcast.
Did you say AIM?
Skype. Look, I'm old. I'm literally old.
Did they bring this back? It's like a retro app or something.
I would use it, but we got a message from Tim where he was like, "I strangely want to be the first commenter on the next match." And I don't know what freaked me out more and distracted me more: the fact that I got a message at all, or that someone wanted to be the first comment on this match. But sure. Tim, I will gladly. Normally, I take these short matches. I feel like it's not fair to give that to the guest. But
yeah.
Go ahead and take Shane Hagedorn versus Bobby Dempsey in what Gabe on commentary called the rematch everyone's been waiting for since Fight of the Century.
That was why I sent the message. I was trying to be discreet so it wouldn't mess up the recording. And then when I saw how much you were flustered, I was like, oh, no, I've completely messed up because I didn't want to interrupt and be like,
anything.
Hey, give me first crack at this one. But no, like, and also I understand why you wouldn't want to give me first crack at it, because it, on paper, it's a bullshit match that's quick and who cares.
Yeah.
But I got a bone to pick with Shane Hagedorn. That son of a bitch. I know that he might hear this, and I just want to call him this and that and run him up. No, the real reason why is that I was talking about how bad the crowd was, but like the crowd was hot for this match on the entrances. When Dempsey comes out, the crowd is fucking going crazy for him. They're into it. He's getting in people's faces. He's got so much charisma. They're booing. They have tons of heat for Hagedorn. They fucking hate him. So I'm just like, the crowd is not bad. It's just stuff that they're invested in. And it makes me think about like how kind of historically the legend, the way people think of the ROH training school, and people think of it as a failure, and oh, it's a money grab. There's like the, you know, Ethan Page talking about in the news, there's like some fresh news about the poor guy just, you know, getting released or whatever, but he famously had that, you know, email open letter that he sent talking about how fucked up the whole tryout scheme system was in ROH. That was like years after this, but either way, people have like really kind of shit on the and I feel like I'm cursing a lot for this podcast. Sorry, I guess you guys curse on here. Anyways,
it's fine.
That the school was bad. But like when you look at this and the quality, and it's not just these guys, like shout out to Mufo Pelli Primo, you know, big, I guess he's not on Twitter, whatever. But either way, like there's a ton of good wrestlers. You mentioned the dark matches with like Alex Payne, Rhett Titus, who's still around. But for the most part, people talk about this first class of ROH students as if they were all fucking losers and dorks who amounted to nothing. But when you watch them here, yes, the match was quick. Yes, it was mostly a storyline. But like they were over. They had personality. The crowd was into it. They were not like terrible. And it's really like the failure was not the students. The failure was like the booking, the story, the company. They failed the students, not the other way around. So that was like one thing that stood out to me a lot about this match. It's like this seemed like a bad crowd, but they were emotionally invested in this and they were really hot for it. So it was more that just like Brent Albright and El Generico didn't tickle their fancies. You know, it was if there was something they were interested in, they were up for it. And there's some stuff later on where you kind of see that as well, where like certain stuff, they were into it. The other thing I wanted to talk about is I don't know if you guys are familiar with C Star Town podcast, but obviously I wouldn't have thought of this at the time because it was way before I even knew who it was. But Bobby Dempsey is remarkably, strikingly just like Stavros Halkias, a famed comedian and podcaster from, but like he kind of looks like him, he kind of acts like him, he has the same vibe, and he's also got the natural, powerful haunches and build of a varsity athlete, the same as Stavros Halkias. So I was like interested in that. I loved the jumping him before the match started. I liked that Hagedorn continued to keep the robe on for the opening seconds, and it reminded me of the great Sasuke in the Super J Cup final match where he kept the robe on as he like did the huge dive to the floor. So this was a ton of energy. The fake out double knucks finish was like neat and kept the heat on Hagedorn. I absolutely thought that this was great for a 6 minute students match. And like I sent a screen cap of a student. Yeah. Was it 2 minutes?
Minutes and 15 seconds. Here's the crazy thing. This match was 2 minutes, 15 seconds. That is 13 and a half times longer than the length of their last match, which was 10 seconds. So they got way more time this
Incredible.
Time.
Incredible. Yeah. And I've probably said enough, but yeah, like I saw a bad review where someone was like, shouldn't this be on the dark, you know, matches? And I was like, no, this rocked. I loved it. They packed so much in 2 minutes that I had tons to talk about from it. But yeah, I'm done.
The other interesting, first off, that was a great review. Normally, like, Matt and I rise to the occasions on, like, the biggest matches where I'll go, oh, I'm really, like, people go, what reviews are you proud of? I'll be like, oh, Bitter Friends is Stiffer Enemies. I think we did a good job on Carino versus Homicide, or, like, Joe versus Punk 2 and 3. That was, like, that level of, like, thoughts and energy for this match. You did it, you know, it's easy to do it for the big matches. You did it for this.
Well, it could only be brought by a guest because we've seen so much of this stuff that it's like we don't really have novel thoughts on it anymore, you know?
Yeah. I will say about this, I enjoyed it enough for what it is, but like Matt said, you know, we've seen a lot of this kind of stuff. But one thing I did notice, like, yeah, it is crazy when you see how dead this crowd gets later. Bobby Dempsey, like, gets a chant in the middle of this match that, like, there are much bigger, more established names on this show that will not get their name chanted on this night. But also this match, like, this match for a 2 minute student match has, like, very good psychology. Like, if you're an ROH completist, because the 10 second match that this is a rematch of was basically Hagedorn hits Dempsey with brass knucks immediately at the start of the match when the ref is, like, looking away and gets the pin almost immediately. 10 second match. And so this match, it's like 2 something minutes. There's not much to it, but it builds to Hagedorn does the same thing. This time the ref catches it, takes the handcuffs. Dempsey, like an idiot, tries to grab the handcuffs from the ref. Like, what, the ref's not going to let you have the handcuffs. This allows Hagedorn to pull out a second pair, hit him for the win. So this actually, like, told a story in 2 minutes that plays off a previous 10-second match. And I guess the other thing I'll say about this is, like, Bobby Dempsey might get more pumped than any wrestler on this roster. When he makes the entrance, he is just screaming over and over, swearing.
No bullshit, you know, like last time. I'm going to cripple this motherfucker. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say his success later in Ring of Honor, like, comes as, like, this real picked on, kind of bullied, poor little, like, meek guy where – here, like, his natural energy is, like, Stavro style, life of the party, screaming his ass off, like, making a point to slap everybody's hand, like, very different. Anyway, but the last thing I'll say before I talk to you,
definitely.
Matt, I would just say is, like, Tim, to your point, and this is a point I made a bunch on the show, but the crazy thing that always strikes me about the Ring of Honor students, and I say this over and over again, is how Ring of Honor in the early years had that history, that reputation of, oh, it's just very plain Jane, meat and potatoes wrestling with no gimmicks, no personalities, no stories. And Matt and I have talked since the start of this podcast how that was always bullshit to varying degrees. But, like, all the Ring of Honor students that, like, succeeded, like, all almost instantly upon their first matches had, like, personalities and character, which is crazy. Like, they all have more than some of the guys on the main roster. Like, Hagedorn instantly had that smarmy, like, henchman of a henchman heel vibe to him before it was even, like, an official thing. You know, Dempsey clearly has charisma here and will end up, like, getting most over as playing a complete, like, character role. You know, Rhett Titus had personality. Pele Primo for playing, like, the ultimate underdog. Grizzly Redwood eventually. Like the Ring of Honor school in the early first couple classes had a very high, like, success rate for guys to have some kind of personality or character. And it was funny because, like, the guy that was considered the star and the brightest prospect of, like, the first class and got the most hype was Davey Andrews, who was much more of the black tights, growly, hit you hard, generic indie guy, and he just quickly vanished. And the guys that kind of stuck around that we remember to this day are the guys that had the personality, that found the gimmicks. But Matt, what'd you think?
What I like about Bobby Dempsey is, yeah, he does do that, like, excited, screaming, charismatic entrance. And I do remember that you know, before he started being featured more, he did seem like just like a mild-mannered, nice guy. I remember him like tearing my tickets a couple of times. Even Joe versus Kobashi, where I remember like sprinting into the building because I was almost late, and like he was there and he gave me a ticket. He's like, "Oh, wait a minute, I gave you the wrong side. Sorry." You know, he tore the ticket and gave me like the wrong half of it. And I was thinking like that probably wouldn't have mattered anyway, but because he was the one letting me in. But I he seemed like a very nice guy and a humble dude. But he did a great job of the screaming entrance. I described this match as like a short but high energy attitude era special, you know, right down to the finish. And I really loved the second pair of Nux, and like they both had a lot of energy, and I really can't complain about it. I thought it was, you know, one of the more enjoyable student matches despite being short. I think, yeah, I agree with both of you. They were both of these guys were doing a very good job at this point with what they were asked to do. I will say, as far as Davey Andrews being like a black tights guy, I'm pretty sure the black tights thing was like a CM Punk sort of directive.
Yeah, they all did. Yeah, right? Yeah. I should have clarified that. Yeah, they all did. Yeah, he was trying to emulate the New Japan Dojo.
Right.
Anyway.
That's all I got to say about that.
I really want to continue on talking about Bobby Dempsey a ton. I've got like, I was like digging through his, I was doing research because some of his last matches were like for an indie company that I know people who are involved with, like the people who book it. And some actually some of them are with people who I do know the booker. So I was like, so if we want to go just all out talking about Bobby Dempsey, at one point, relatively recently, he started going by 138 instead of Bobby Dempsey. I mean, that's just, Trevor, continue on, please.
Okay, so actually, I'm going to now punish you, Tim, for doing a great job, because normally on the show, if people who have listened will know, I try and alternate. Occasionally, I lose track of who gets to go next, but I always try and alternate who gets to choose each match. I mean, who gets to go first on each match, so everyone gets a chance to have fresh, be the first opinion to matches. And I had you penciled in as this one, because I was going to take the second one, and I thought, oh, great, now I have to take this one. And you know what? Then I realized, like, this is Matt and I's show. You're the guest. You have to do what we say. So you know what? You did a good job with the last match. I'm going to challenge you. Delirious defeats Jason Blade via submission in 9 minutes, 25 seconds. We made him tap out to the Cobra Stretch. Make this one interesting for us. Because
Oh, you are correct. But here's the interesting side of this is Gabe's commentary. I don't even know if this is Jimmy Bauer. I don't know who it is. Jimmy. Is this Jimmy Bauer? I forget who's what.
Chris Lovey is early era Gabe. Jimmy Bauer is like most of the rest of it.
The most interesting part of this match is how much Gabe is really focusing on trying to tell us the story about like wrestlers being able to move their way up the card in the company and like not just, you know, oh, you can lose but have an impressive showing and that will get you coming back, but you got to get those wins to really move up the card and be sure that you're going to be on every show and this and that. And it's almost, again, it's, you know, it's trademark Gabe on commentary, you know, Jimmy Bauer on commentary. I shouldn't break kayfabe, right?
We always just say Gabe. It's fine.
Yeah. He's like ribbing on the square somewhat, where it's like, these are two guys who, I mean, obviously Jason Blade, like people don't even fucking talk about this guy anymore. Delirious as well, but like these are two guys who never make it to that next level, and like they get to this point and to just like being prominently featured to where you almost think like kind of the fact that he's harping on that so much during this match is he's kind of speaking to that, like that these are two guys who are really on the bubble but don't quite get there, which I do find kind of interesting. And what Delirious does show in this match is like having the shtick, having the personality, doing the stuff that makes him worthwhile to have around, but he's never going to make it to the next level. I like that somewhere in there, he's even talking about like, he's, like I said, he's really hard selling it by like referencing like Colt Cabana and CM Punk and how these guys, like they feuded over trans and getting plane tickets and look at where they are now. He loves at this point. He is like the proverbial, you know, cat that caught the canary. Gabe is when it comes to CM Punk, like that's his biggest achievement, it seems, in a lot of ways, which is kind of interesting when you think about it, because like in a lot of ways Gabe is like Heyman, you know, it's his mentor, he learned from him in a lot of ways. You can see it in their booking styles, you can see it in the way that they politically mover and the way that they
you can
like
see it
interact
in their appearances in his appearance. I love that you mentioned that, because Gabe, we'll get to it later, Gabe never looks more physically like Paul Heyman than he does on this show.
Yeah, exactly. Like they're so similar in a lot of ways. But one thing that Heyman never did was kind of what Gabe does here, big on this episode. I was going to say this podcast, on this wrestling show, on his commentary. He is so proud of feeling like he launched CM Punk. He's like really trying to take credit for creating CM Punk. And you never got that from Heyman. Like Heyman almost never tried to be like, this guy was my guy. I saw it. I made him a star. And the reason why he would do like the general oeuvre. He'd be like, yeah, you know, Eric Bischoff sees my guys and he steals them. But he wouldn't like pick out a specific guy and be like, that guy, I made him a star, you know. And Gabe was really – he's really proud of Punk.
But the funny part is like it was way more true of Heyman. Like Gabe obviously like did, you know, kind of raise the profile of certain guys. But almost all the guys that were pushed in ROH were guys that were already like seen as some of the best indie talent in the country before that. Like CM Punk was can't miss right. before he came to ROH. Like – when you look at some of the people that Paul Heyman turned into stars, I feel like a lot of those guys were people that almost no one else would have seen at that level, and Paul had some sort of magic. Like I was just thinking about this recently because I was going back and listening through the old Joe Lanza, Jovember to Remembers, and then just thinking more about ECW, and I watched the Dark Side of the Ring about the Sandman, and it was like, I don't know, would anyone else have done what Heyman did with the Sandman and turned him into like that kind, like, you know, maybe someone would have pushed the Sandman, but like turned him into that kind of iconic figure. I don't know. CM Punk, I feel like as great as ROH did with him, he didn't need ROH, if that makes sense. No. Bryan Danielson too. Like Bryan Danielson was an all-time great wrestler. And ROH, you know, capitalized on that. But everyone knew Bryan Danielson was amazing before he went to ROH. That's why he was pushed to the top in ROH. You know, Samoa Joe was, you know, made champion in some other indies before he went to ROH. Loki, obviously. You know, it's – I guess, you know, we talked about Paul London maybe being the one guy. But even he, you know, had so much athleticism. Heyman did it with people that really were kind of misfits. So I don't want to, like, take anything away from Gabe, but – you know, he's not quite Paul Heyman in terms of finding these diamonds in the rough and turning them into superstars or icons. You know what I mean?
Well, one thing I would say, like the way I would look at it differently is I would say I think both Gabe and Paul, when you look at them talk, like Tim, I really noticed the commentary for this one too. When you look at how they talk about Tim, like what you pointed out, I think the big difference is they're both taking like the opposite approaches at how to handle the same problem, which is ECW and Ring of Honor both had, which is when you're a smaller promotion, if talent gets hot, it's going to get plucked by someone else. And Matt, you just did a great job explaining why, you know, a lot of the talent in ECW were kind of mirages, where when they weren't in the ECW setting with the ECW presentation, they did not look as good. Where Ring of Honor, yeah, there was a difference where if a talent looked really good in Ring of Honor, generally they were just a really good talent that if they were pushed properly would succeed elsewhere. But I would say the difference between their approaches on commentary would be, I think in ECW they tried to soften the blow of losing big stars by, you know, doing the us versus them, being like, well, if they left, they fucking sold out, you know, fuck them then, you know, they weren't true believers then to the kind of the underground that we're going to make this big. Where Gabe tried to go the other way, where he kind of always, I felt like when I listened to him on commentary here, I feel like he's almost trying to soft sell the idea that like you come to Ring of Honor because you're going to see future stars here and you should just expect like they're going to leave, you know?
Right. And what Gabe did for these guys was he didn't like find them and like this guy no one realized was talented and I'm going to find the spark in him. He just took guys where it's like they were so small that WWE didn't want them right away. So he was going to feature them and get them buzz and then WWE or whoever would want them, you know?
Yeah, so when I hear Gabe on commentary, I also feel like, yeah, maybe he wants some credit, but also I think he's trying to sell it as like, hey, you know, guys, that's part of the plan here. Like, we know from the start that we're going to get guys into Ring of Honor, and if they succeed, they're going to come up, they're going to rise to the ranks, and then they're going to leave forever to the big leagues, and that's by design. So maybe that kind of softens the blow of, like, losing them, where ECW was more of the opposite, where I feel it was like, well, fuck them then, you know, fuck them for leaving, you know, they weren't that cool anyway then.
Especially.
Which is funny because.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, it's funny when you say that because it almost plays off of something that's specifically like more intrinsic to Punk than anybody that Heyman ever booked, which is the straight edge credo, if you're not now, you never were. And that was the thing that Heyman kind of understood, right? If you ever leave ECW, then you never were ECW. Just like the straight edge thing. If you ever aren't straight edge anymore, then you never were straight edge. But Punk is the guy that he leaves ROH and Gabe is like, yeah, he was the best of us. He was actually the greatest guy who's ever been in ROH. And isn't it cool that we saw it first?
And if you watch like early Ring of Honor, you can see the transition from the ECW way of thinking and that audience to the ROH one. Because the first couple guys that leave, there's at least one of them, or I think maybe a couple, it might be even like Paul Leonard or a couple of them, where one or two isolated people, like when they're giving their goodbye speech, chant, "You sold out." And like other people boo him, the wrestler at least one time like stopped to acknowledge that wrestler, I mean that fan. And
well, it was well, like, well, there Punk, was still, Punk, like, Punk did it on one of his last appearances in ROH.
Yeah. And it became, you know, because, you know, ECW kind of created that on the indie level, that was the norm, right? Like, that was how you said goodbye to wrestlers, was that you basically told them to fuck off. And you said, like, we resent you for leaving. Maybe you throw in a please don't go and kind of mix some positive with negative. But, you know, when we get into Ring of Honor and when we get into, like, later PWG, it becomes much more just the please don't go and thank you and almost no, you sold out. So...
I mean, I've been in a PWG crowd where we're chanting, "You deserve it," for someone who's leaving. And they're not just leaving, but we know that they're leaving to an evil company, right? They're leaving to, and I was going to say the H, you know, the H word that I shouldn't say, but that, you know, that they're going to a bad place and you're still saying you deserve it because you just mean you deserve the money.
Yeah, you're getting money and recognition. And like, even though we know personally, we won't enjoy, you know? Well, sorry. Why did you, Matt, could you just say that again?
Because I've talked over you. The money and also the spotlight and the recognition and all that stuff.
Yeah. It's that idea of, in a way, fans becoming a little more civilized and a little more melancholy in the fact of, like, we know we're not going to enjoy you as much in the big leagues, but, like, it's going to be a better life for you. You know?
You know what's funny about that?
What?
So for a long time, when it came to Bryan Danielson, when he went to WWE, I was, you know, I was more optimistic than a lot of people. I was like, he's so good. He'll do well there, even if it takes a little while. And I think I was right about that. And I remember thinking, like, you know what? It's great that he left. Like, he's been great in WWE. He had a great, you know, he had some great runs. You know, not everything was great. You know, they did some stupid stuff with him, but you know, he did a very good job there. He was the best guy there. He got over as the biggest babyface in many years for a certain period of time. It was great. But then when he left WWE and started going back to just like being the American Dragon and like doing what he does in AEW, that's when I realized, like, oh no, like that was like, we missed out on a lot of Bryan Danielson being in WWE. Like, this was so much better. It's sort of like, it was almost like a little bit of when before AEW, like when WWE really did have essentially a monopoly on Major League American wrestling. It really was a little bit of like a Stockholm syndrome where it was like, oh, this is the best we could ask for, I guess. And so we'll take, you know, it's just weird to think about it that way.
Yeah, I guess we should get to this match. I think we're having a good discussion, but I also think we want to do everything to avoid talking about this match. But
Trevor, you told me to make this good. And
you did.
I did.
Yes, you did. No, you did.
Matt, I do. I want to say that I hear you. And you're valid, and I understand that talking point, and I've even somewhat agreed with it in the past, but I do argue that I personally believe, and not just for me and my taste, but I do think, bigger picture, there's a certain segment of the fan base and wrestling, you know, intelligentsia, I'll say, to even kind of wink and nod at what I'm talking about here, that would never have accepted Bryan Danielson as what I currently and will probably, for all intents and purposes, for a very long time, believe is the greatest wrestler of all time. Number one, Hall of Famer. There is a segment of the fans that I don't think would have ever accepted him at that level if he did not have a run as the top guy in the top company. So while I agree with you that maybe it wasn't like the peak of his performance, and it's hard to compare it, but I did have it cross my mind where it's kind of like Terry Funk, who's probably like the number two greatest of all time, right? And it's this thing where it's like, the fact that he's able to be this good in every setting is partly what makes that argument for him being the greatest of all time. It's a little bit more difficult with the Danielson WWE run because of how bad WWE is, where it's like you can point to it and be like, well, it's kind of like Terry Funk scuzzing it around in ECW or some of the like weirder gimmick stuff that he does in NWA, like throughout his career, where it's like it's not the peak. It's not the best stuff he ever does. Or you can say like the deathmatch stuff in FMW, and you can say, yeah, that's not like the best wrestling he does in his entire career. But the fact that he's able to be the best wrestler in the world, even doing something like that, is what is able to like make you argue for the fact that he is the greatest of all time. Danielson does the same thing in WWE, where it's like the fact that he's able to still deliver in a setting that's that bad also kind of speaks to just how great he is. So I think we would have been better off quality wise if we had gotten 10 more years of him wrestling not in WWE. I think that it helps bolster that case to say he is the greatest wrestler of all time because he was able to do that.
Yeah. I agree with you. Trevor, let me just say one more thing to respond to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
And then I'll pivot back to the match.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So the other thing I was going to say, just to kind of add to your point, Tim, I think you're right. Like, ultimately, you're right. Like, I think, I'm glad that he got the run in WWE, obviously. And, like, him winning at WrestleMania 30 is, you know, as a huge Bryan Danielson fan, is one of my favorite moments as a wrestling fan. Like, easily, for sure. And, you know, I liked a lot of stuff about his run. I will say this, though. Because WWE was, like, one foot in and one foot out with him and, like, reluctantly pushed him, I do think a large segment of fans that are persuadable by WWE hype do not see him on the level that we see him, or that a lot of other people – like there's a large segment of fans that when you say, like – who's better, Bryan Danielson or Kurt Angle? They're like what? Like Daniel Bryan? Like, why would you even compare those two? Like, they're not even in the same universe. Obviously, Kurt Angle is so much better. Like, because WWE never fully got behind him and pushed his legacy and gave him those opportunities the way they did for guys like Angle or Orton or Michaels, obviously, or Undertaker or Edge or, you know, a million other people. People like, a lot of fans do not see Bryan Danielson like that world beater type. If you weren't already sort of apt to think of Bryan Danielson as a phenomenal wrestler before he got his WWE push, I don't think a lot of the WWE fans ever realized he was that good, because WWE never really promoted him that way. Even when he was pushed as the top guy, you know, the promotion was basically saying he's a B-plus player, you know, he's an underdog, he's, you know, like, it's just, it's strange. They never gave him that status. So he never, I think, is going to have it in the eyes of a lot of people. And then just to pivot back to the match, Trevor, I'll say,
can I have just,
I'd like to see you trying that.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And I think that you're 100% correct on that. And I just want to say that I definitely see where you're coming from in that regard. That like those fans are never going to accept him that way. And I just think that what we have to do is we have to fire up the old PWO network, podcast network, and we have to do the Bryan Danielson Making the Case, me and you, Matt, so that we can actually get really, really like tear apart this case for Bryan Danielson as the greatest wrestler ever.
Well, Tim, I will just tell you right now, Trevor and I have a plan. If this Bryan Danielson
wonderful
semi-retirement actually comes to fruition, we got a plan, and you'll be part of it. As far as the match, so Trevor, what I realized by this conversation is, and I've brought this up before, as much as the commentary in ROH has gotten better, we have lost a lot of talking points from the commentary getting better. Because back in the day, Trevor, a lot of the stuff we talked about would be the crazy things that would be said on commentary by Gabe or any of the other colorful characters that crossed the ROH booth's path. And here we get to see Gabe kind of come back and like say stuff that gives us a lot of conversation. Him obsessively talking about how you could rise up the ranks in ROH. As a kind of a backdrop to to a kind of drab, basic, indie type. I mean, you know, high quality indie match, but still an indie match. You know, like talking about how, you know, these Delirious is moving up the card, which leaves an opening for guys like Jason Blade. And then it's like, yeah, but not really Jason Blade. I mean, Jason Blade stays at this exact level for the rest of his time in ROH, which I think ends the minute that Gabe stops being a booker, right? Like Gabe goes away and then Jason Blade goes away, right?
Jason Blade's one of those weird guys where, like, if you look at his cage match, like I did researching the show, like, Gabe would, like, use him for a little bit, but then, like, eh, maybe you just stay in FIP and then use him for a little bit. Like there, he wasn't, he gave him a few shots, but, like, he never took. But he kept coming back to him, which is, like, an interesting kind of middle ground for a talent.
Yeah. Now, in this match, you know, I think he does some okay stuff. Like, you know, he does his dive to the floor was really very good. And, you know, I felt really bad for him when he does that, like almost like Oscutter type of, you know, jumping backwards and then getting his legs caught. Cause it's like Gabe's going on and on about what an opportunity this is for him. And then he has a very conspicuous botch. And, you know, getting that rude, you fucked up chant from the Jersey crowd. And, you know, I don't think that spot.
Now, Matt, really quickly, Matt, did you think that maybe if Delirious was a little bit more, you know, if he wasn't such a madman, he was a little bit more, you know, with it mentally, he could have done, I think the spot or the concept that you coined in the last podcast, which is that he should have blamed that you fucked up chant on his opponent there. He could have pointed at Jason Blade and been like, yeah, he did fuck up.
Yeah. I mean, definitely not. That definitely was what Nigel would have done. Obviously, Delirious. He's too crazy. Can't speak English. But it is kind of fun to think about Delirious saying, starting a Delirious Ease version of a "you fucked up" chant. So yeah, I think that probably would have been a good cover because it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like a fuck up in a cooperation spot. Those are always the worst, right? Those are always the ones that really take you out of the match. Anybody who's doing a back spring could get their legs caught. But yeah, it just kind of led to that sudden tap out where Delirious blocked the third rolling back suplex, and then Delirious rolls out into a crucifix and the Cobra stretch. I don't know if there was really anything wrong with the match other than that botch, except for the fact that it was just kind of dry. At the end, they did get the tough crowd reacting a little bit at points, but I don't think that this match did for Jason Blade what seemed to be what the goal was, if Gabe's commentary was any indication. So I think this match sort of was just really forgettable, other than the commentary, which I guess will make this a memorable segment for us.
Yeah.
I would call this match. Go on.
Okay. I was going to say that the biggest issue with the match, that like what made it negative, was just like that it was impossible really to tell who was supposed to be like the heel or the babyface. Like that made it difficult. Like, Blade kind of worked like a babyface, but it would make more sense for him to be a heel, especially early on when he's doing the arm drags and Gabe is saying, oh, picture perfect arm drags. You know, and that's like just like Steamboat. And it's like, okay, well, Steamboat's one of the all-time great babyfaces. So is this guy supposed to be a babyface? He hits a really nice looking like vertical drop kick that is like a babyface high spot, especially old school. So yeah, it's just like a lot of it, Blade wrestles like a babyface, but he doesn't really make sense as a babyface. And that would be, again, my biggest negative on the match, as Matt mentioned, like what's bad about the match. Like, not much other than I can't tell who the fuck I'm supposed to cheer and who I'm supposed to boo. But there's a match that's very similar later on the show that's really similar in a lot of ways. But I think that they did a much better job of kind of like dealing with the fact that you can't tell who's supposed to be a heel and who's supposed to be a babyface. And I'm sorry. I've been stretching this out too much. Let's continue on.
You know how it is when you review three matches and they're like barely like 15 minutes worth of combined match time and you're over an hour into a podcast. No, this has been great. But I would just say this match was exceedingly average. I thought the most interesting parts were the commentary that we've talked about, and also how a lot of times when you see a guy that's really well established in Ring of Honor and he wrestles a guy that's trying to break in and get like a full-time spot, the really established guy will give like the coming up guy, like a ton of the offense, like most of it, and then win right at the end, where they didn't really work this that way. Like Delirious gave him a decent amount of offense by the end, but for like the body of the match, Delirious takes a lot of the match. He has like a really dominant personality that kind of overshadows like your opponent. Like if I was a wrestler trying to break in with Ring of Honor in this period, I would not want to wrestle Delirious just because I'd be like, it's going to be hard for my personality to stand out like next to this guy, like throwing fans hats and doing 18 different comedy spots. But yeah, and you watch Jason Blade, and I think you see why he's kind of like had the run in Ring of Honor, which he did, which is, you know, he's not bad. He's not amazing. He has some, like you guys mentioned, like some solid athleticism, like that really nice drop kick. You know, he can do a nice dive to the floor. And then he had that key botch that I felt bad for, because like this is the worst match for him to have a botch on, although he will get more shots. But yeah, our conversation was probably more interesting than the match. But we will now go to Davey Richards backstage.
Yeah, I got something to say about this promo, but go ahead.
Oh, God. Davey says since the first day he was in Ring of Honor, he's been tested and tested, all leading up to the Fight of the Century show, which he says might as well have been called Test of the Century for me. Davey talks about how he faced Kent on that show, the man who chose him to be his American protege. And while he lost that night, he proved to Kenta that he could be his protege. Then at Honor Reclaims Boston, he and Kenta faced Austin Aries and Roderick Strong. Aries beat Davey to win that match. And a month earlier, Aries had already beaten Davey Richards in a singles match on a different show.
Okay, so I have to interrupt because this is the part. He goes, at Honor Reclaims Boston, you beat me. And then he goes, and to pour salt on the wound, you beat me again a month earlier at Glorified Honor. I was like, wait, what's happening here? You're pouring salt in the wound by doing something before? Like, that's...
You put... What he meant to say is
you poured salt on my to cut me later.
Yeah. Exactly. You put salt on my arm and then cut me a month late.
Yeah, it was like, is there some Back to the Future kinds of stuff going on here? Because that makes this one of the more interesting promos that I've ever heard, actually.
Related to that, the closing line is like very similar, where it's like, I was just like, is this a distinction without a difference? Does it really mean something better or worse? But he's like, tonight I will beat you. No. Tonight I have to beat you. And it's like, how is that saying will feels more definitive than saying I have to?
Right.
Because have to still leaves the idea that you could fail. If you just say I will beat you, then you're going to beat him.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah.
Clearly, like, he's getting lost in his logic in some of these lines.
Yeah, I mean, Davey, yeah, like I said, he just says, you know, you're my biggest test, Aries, you're my biggest obstacle. He slaps himself in the face, then does what Tim talked about. He says, you know, I have to beat you. Tonight, he goes, you fall to Davey Richards. And, yeah, I mean, you could say this about Davey Richards. He had charisma. He was really putting energy and trying, but the substance was zero, and he was pretty, I guess the kids would say, cringe. Like, memorable in a sense, I guess, but yeah.
One thing I forgot, because I didn't really see Davey in person. I did see Davey in person a bunch, but then I did see him like again for the first time years later in I was gonna say like Prestige or something. Anyways, but like I got so used to him and this and that, but seeing him again here cutting this promo up close when he was so much younger, I was like, I forgot how handsome Davey was early on, because he turns into such a little freaky bat boy. He looks like the kid from the Munsters later in his career, that I forgot about how handsome he was when he was young. Because, yeah, like, he's dumb, but you're just like, oh, shut up, you stupid idiot. Please stop talking. You know, like, just let me look at you. Just let me appreciate you, you know? And, like, yeah, that was one thing I forgot. But watching this promo, I was like, God, he was a piece of ass when he was young.
And that brings us, I see, and because I have a Davey Richards level ability to think on my feet, I do not have a good transition from a nice piece of ass to the grudge match, BJ Whitmer versus Jimmy Jacobs, escorted to the ring by Lacey. Now, Cage Match says this went to a no contest in 13 minutes. I don't know if technically this was even a match, because I never heard a bell rung to begin with. This might have just been what was a scheduled match that turned into a long segment, but for all intents and purposes, it was basically a match. Yeah, so basically what happens is
Whitmer marks me.
Nope, because I started with you for the last two matches. I'm taking this one. do you want to start this one?
No, I was kidding. I was like, I'll just run us off the road again.
Okay. So, yeah, this match starts with, Whitmer marches to the ring after his entrance, and he and Jacobs just immediately start brawling. They both shove ref Paul Turner to the mat at different times as he tries to break it up before they finally team up, throw him over the top rope to the floor when he tries to break it up a third time. So a lot of this match is doing spots with the ref to really try and sell it like, you know, this feud's out of control and this match is not going to have a finish and we're going to justify it by doing this stuff. You know, they brawl around ringside in the ring and they throw in a few wrestling moves, which are actually some of the more interesting spots, like Jacobs gets suplexed on the metal entrance ramp, which doesn't happen that often in Ring of Honor. He does a Rana off the barricade. He gets power bombed onto the barricade. There's a big late match moment where he reverse Rana's Whitmer and BJ just pops right up and lariats the shit out of Jimmy. But most importantly, there's lots of punching here and lots of blood. This is like the rare singles match in wrestling where there is triple juice because Whitmer has a great blade job here. Jimmy has, I would say, a pretty good one. And ref Paul Turner even blades because all three men get spiked at different points in this match because Jimmy Jacobs brings back the spike, the railroad spike. And overall, I thought this was fun. Like if I was rating this as a match, I don't know, like a strong good, like maybe a tiny bit better, like 3.5 stars. I think one negative is the Paul Turner stuff got a little goofy and strained wrestling logic. Like, again, I completely get what they get. We're going for trying to sell this is out of control. This match isn't going to have a finish, but like you go from at one point where Turner is selling forever from a simple toss to the floor. And then later he has to recover fairly quickly from Jimmy Jacobs hitting him in the head with a railroad spike so that he can do a spot where BJ Whitmer does the same thing to him. And then it's another wrestling logic thing where it's like, if the match did start, why does he call for a DQ? And if the match never started, why don't people flood the ring once it becomes very apparent very quickly how out of control this is? Because, in fact, the end of the match is Daisy Hayes comes to the ring with, like, an army of students and refs near the end of the match to break things up. And, you know, that could have technically been the finish a minute in instead of 13 minutes in. But other than that, I like the key spots. I like the blood. I liked it as a middle chapter to prolong the feud. And what I really liked, though, was, like, my favorite part was actually the final minute or two where I thought Jacobs and Whitmer both did a great job of just selling being beat to shit. Like, first they both end up just dropping to their knees and continuing to hit and slap and kick each other from their knees. And then when the finish happens where, like, Lacey comes in, she starts kicking at Whitmer, and then Daisy Hayes comes in to brawl with Lacey and send her, like, running to the back. I thought the great thing there was as, like, Lacey and Daisy are doing stuff, Whitmer and Jacobs keep never recover. Like, multiple times when the girls get near them, they, like, reach up and fumble and try and grab them to stop them or defend themselves, but in a way that's, like, really ugly in a good way. Like, it feels like they're barely conscious and, like, they're making no dramatic comeback. They feel like, ugh, like, just please. They're acting like someone's trying to wake them up. Like, please just come on. And for me, I actually really like that. But, Matt, what did you think about this?
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, in a lot of ways, I thought this was awesome. Like, I thought it was a really good, like, raising the stakes emotionally after a pretty dry period in ROH. You know, it escalated this feud, and I think it added a new dimension to Jimmy Jacobs to have a match like this, and, you know, that he hasn't had, like, anything like this in a long time. And I'd say it was refreshingly emotional and exciting, but I really was annoyed by some of the logic gaps, like the Paul Turner stuff especially. Like, to me, it's like, if the wrestlers start mutilating the referee, people should, like, other officials should be out there. Like, you know, like, at least another ref coming out to get beaten up, you know, somebody. It made it seem like ROH was just, like, the most callous company in the world. They're just like, oh yeah, I guess the referee's getting assaulted. They just know, and nobody is going to do anything about it. And then Nobody cares until, like, Daisy Hayes just happens to look at them and then calls them out. And obviously, that means that everyone was watching because they saw her just, like, motion to the back to call everyone out. So, like, that took me out of it a little bit. But I'd say on a net, I thought this was very good because I just liked the way it raised the stakes.
Yeah, and Tim, what do you think? Like, this is a big for through the years, because I think, Matt, I should ask you, like, I don't think there's ever been a ref that's like taken this much of a beating, like even close in the history of Ring of Honor up to this point. Like,
yeah,
getting like blading and getting hit this often by. So yeah, again, that getting, really getting, does sound getting, like getting, it's kind
getting
of ridiculous.
Spiked. Getting spiked. Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously, yeah, no, not even close. Yeah.
And that no one tries to stop. Like, you can think of, there's been so many angles in Ring of Honor where they've tried to break up a lot less than this, you know?
Right. Like Homicide starts throwing chairs, and Gabe starts screaming, "It's a riot! Everyone's gonna die! We all gotta leave!" You know? Like, this was much more violent than most of that.
But they wanted to do a whole brawl, and they wanted to tell the story of, like, hey, we're going crazy. We're so crazy. We're both attacking this referee. But, Tim, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of references back to the ECW, a little bit of the ECW chat we were having earlier. Like, and it's funny because at this point, ROH is almost 5 years old, and the ECW parallels are still there that a lot of people didn't notice even early on in the company, but it's clear. Even down to, like, yeah, the referee, Paul Turner here, is doing his best Bill Alfonso. I mean, like, a referee getting juice like that, selling like that, bumping big like that, like, you really didn't see that since, like, yeah, Bill Alfonso in ECW as a referee doing this kind of thing. And the other part, as we were talking about it earlier, and I saved it. I put a little feather in my cap to bring back because that conversation was going long. When you talked about wrestlers and kind of their role in places, if Gabe was more like Heyman, the kind of guy that would be getting poached from him would have been Jimmy Jacobs here, right? As you talked about, the smaller guy who you get the most out of, and you actually realize how good they are because the big leagues would never pick them up, is Jimmy Jacobs. And if you could imagine, like, he would have been, you know, it's a weird comparison because I think most people wouldn't really see it, but it's not necessarily in the wrestling style, but it is in, like, the style of guy, wrestler guy that they are, is that, like, Jimmy Jacobs could have been, like, the Rey Mysterio of his time, like a smaller guy who wrestles this style that people are not really used to, because at this point you weren't seeing this kind of wrestler on major league television. And like, he could have easily been the same thing that happened with Rey Mysterio going to WCW, where it's like Paul Heyman exposes him, blah, 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 whatever. That said, I liked, there was like, this is like a deep vein thrombozo spot that I enjoyed, was like, it felt like they did so much. They worked so hard to not have man on woman violence in this match with Lacey, like, teasing that Lacey's going to get spiked, but she runs around, she plays cat and mouse, Jimmy cuts her off, but then Daisy comes out, it's, you know, in the middle of it, and, like, then Jimmy is, like, aggressively, violently pawing at her, and you kind of referenced it where it's, like, the idea that they never really caught their bearings, but it did feel as if he was, you know, he was on the borderline. I feel like it's close enough to man-on-woman violence, the way that Jimmy was groping at her in an aggressive nature, yeah, while he had blood in his eyes. So it was like, God, you guys came so close to not doing man-on-woman violence. And the Daisy, you know, I'm a big fan of Daisy Hayes. I always really thought that she was, like, underutilized, very talented. Yeah. It doesn't hurt that I find her attractive, you know, whatever. But, like, I do think that she's very talented in general and never really got her due. And you could tell that what they wanted to do here was have her kind of play the role of, like, a scream queen from a horror movie, right? Where it's the idea that, yeah, her coming out to the ring and what she saw, the viscera and the gruesomeness of what was happening, was so insane. It was, but it was leveled up by her reaction and the way that she screamed. And she did a good job. And it may have to do with the miking or whatever, but, like, her screaming and her reaction was supposed to be the thing that set off the idea that this is not just a match. And the commentary team, they kind of tried to say it, but it felt like it was, like, a little bit weak, and I really did not enjoy the finish. It felt like a really dumb way to end the match, especially, as you guys already said, there's, like, logic holes with how much has already happened, and then now you're just ending it because a lady is upset. It's like, you guys, the referee has been stabbed in the face multiple times with a fucking railway spike, and now we're ending the match in a no contest because this lady got mad, or she got her feelings hurt. Like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of Daisy Hayes, too, in the early years of Ring of Honor. And I do think it says something that they probably, someone there saw something in her, too, because so often in Ring of Honor with these low-card acts, especially women, like, when one act for them ends, they kind of just drop them completely. And clearly here, they were trying to find something for her to do after the embassy by, like, sticking her in this feud, where you look at someone like even like Allison Danger, when once Christopher Daniels leaves next year, she goes with him because they're just like, well, we're not gonna find something else for you either. But there was a real lack of like great tidbits for this juicy tidbits for the show. But there was one, and it's right here, and this might be explains some of the fumbling that Whitmer and Jacobs was doing, because most of this did not make the DVD. This is from a live report, and I kind of love this. This is from a PW Torch live report from Michael Mansfield and Adam M., and they wrote, "People were confused when Daisy Hayes ran out to attack Lacey, then just started screaming in horror at, quote, all, unquote, the blood, and asked people to get help. They even had her intentionally wear a white shirt so the blood would look better as she cradled Whitmer and Jacob's heads in her arms, but it just looked ridiculous when you could clearly see the guys actually rubbing their faces back and forth on her shirt to make it more bloody. The real funny part came after the match when Adam Pearce came out with some towels to clean up the blood on the mat, of which there was none, so the poor guy had to go out there and wipe up imaginary blood." I will say, okay, this: you watch the DVD, you do not see any of that.
Yeah, I don't remember that. Yeah,
yeah.
I went back to make sure. You see none of that. If you look really closely, you can see it looks like Whitmer at one point is trying to like rub his face on Daisy's shirt, but like any of this prolonged stuff, and you don't see Adam Pearce at all. So any of that was not on the DVD. So that was kind of shocking to read. But that is kind of funny that they're imaginary pools of blood. They were really trying to sell that this was just like the death of these guys. And that brings us to the FIP heavyweight title match. Roderick Strong defeated Shingo via pinfall in 10 minutes, 45 seconds after hitting a Gibson driver on a chair. Matt, I'm going to give it to you, but first a couple of things to say. So first off, I guess there's a little preamble before the match, which I should recap, which is, first off, I like that during his entrance, Shingo points at the ringside table and he smiles and he looks at a fan and he says, "table" to the fan at ring. I continue to love that their whole character for Shingo is Shingo Love Table. Before the match, Roddy gets on the mic and he tells a heckling fan, if he thinks he can do better, get in the ring and let's go. And then Roddy says, "In Chicago, Shingo, you put me through a table. Last night in Long Island, you put me through another table." So Roddy says, "In FIP, the wrestlers make the rules, and I'm the most important wrestler of them all. Since I'm FIP champion, how about we make tables legal tonight?" Shingo's happy about that because Shingo loves table. Roddy says, "To make it more fun, let's make chairs legal too." And then he says, "Let's make," and before he even finishes the sentence, he just proceeds to hit Shingo with the mic in the head and makes a really loud sound to start the match. So Matt, before I throw it to you, I'll just say this. Another example of how Through the Years always syncs up with the real world. On a recent show, mostly me delighted in Jay Briscoe calling Shingo Chango. Today, as we record this, is coming right after a backlash happened in France, and they've started, you know, to talk more about acknowledged wrestling outside of the world of WWE. And one of the commentators noted that Tama Tonga, new signing, had wrestled in New Japan in great matches, including against a guy named Shinto. So Shinto, Chango, great. The names keep adding up, Matt. What'd you think about Shinto here in this match against Roderick Strong? A match in a feud built around tables. Matt, tell the people, how many tables were used in this match?
I thought that was one of the coolest things about the match, because like they are, you know, wrestling companies are terrified of not giving fans tables when they make them expect tables, right? But yeah, zero tables gone through in this match, and I appreciated it, I gotta say. So this is like, they start out like in a brawling style, and because the crowd is not super into it because they're just a quiet crowd in general, like, but I do think they look interested, if that makes sense. Like, it doesn't seem like the crowd doesn't give a shit about this. They're just kind of quiet because that's just how they are for a lot of this. They do boo a Shingo low blow, and the announcers say that might be legal, but they're not sure. And I'm just like, well, if they're not sure, is the ref sure? Because I don't think anything was established. It was kind of a weird point. But yeah, in general, I thought like this was Shingo's most fun singles match in ROH yet. It was pretty fast paced, like hard hitting, some cool moves, you know, a bunch of like hard strikes changed. Shingo ducks a strong clothesline, hits a big one of his own, and then the spinning power bomb. And then Shingo gets Strong, like, straddled across the ropes, hits him with the chair, and then DDT Strong onto the open chair, which is a pretty, you know, big spot in, like, a fourth match on the show, a fifth match on the show. And, you know, it's kind of hard to, I guess, make the crowd react to, like, weapons and stuff after such a crazy brawl that they had the match before, but I thought the crowd did get into some of the chair stuff later on. When Shingo went for the blood fall, but Strong escaped and then ducked the chair shot, hit the double knees and threw the chair right at Shingo's head before hitting the sick kick and Gibson driving him onto the chair for the win. I thought, like, considering what they had to follow and considering how weak the crowd was, I think they did a pretty good job here. Obviously, I think these two guys could do even better, and they were just having, like, an undercard-style match. But I definitely liked it more than their first match, I'd say by a pretty significant amount. And I think Shingo is doing a pretty good job getting his footing in ROH.
Tim, what do you think about this?
Well, one thing that I thought was glaring, and I did appreciate the pre-match promo, Roddy grabs the mic. One of the first things he says is, like, if you think you could do better, get in the ring, but you don't know what the fuck he's talking about, because it's like he's just responding to some fan in the audience. This is, yeah, like, why you don't talk about, you know, current things that are going on in Backlash France on a podcast that's evergreen. When I'm watching it now, I don't know what's happening. But Roddy does say in his opening promo, he does mention how Shingo likes tables, like, which I did appreciate, you know, because it played into, like, Shingo likes, yeah, tables.
Well, that's something that they've said over and over again now. Just Shingo likes tables. Shingo really likes tables. There was a promo that he did after their first match where Shingo's just like, I like tables. Like, that's literally his gimmick, is just he likes tables, which I think everyone likes tables. I mean, that's usually what we use to eat or do work. I mean, I guess desks. I guess desks are tables, right? Are desks tables?
Yeah, it's a kind of table. It's like a square thing.
Yeah, is this like a hot dog a sandwich? Is a desk a table? But yes, I think we all like tables. The question is, do we like using tables as a weapon? And I don't, but I guess Shingo does.
He does. He enjoys it. I really thought that the opening bit of Shingo's entrance music, where it just goes Dragon Gate USA, that popped me. I just thought that was very funny. It was also predicting the future, because Dragon Gate USA didn't exist at this point,
yeah,
but it does become a thing later. So, oh shit! All right, Gabe kind of was calling his shot. I know it was. It's, you know, you guys talked about the slow and steady pace of through the years here. It was 2 months ago for you guys when you watched their first match against each other. And I did tell Matt this, that part of why I picked this show was specifically this match. So I went back and watched their first match before I watched this. And for you guys, like I said, it was 2 months ago when you reviewed it. It was a month before this. And it was kind of shocking just how glaringly different, like, Roddy was in a month. Roderick Strong really felt like almost a different wrestler, like, not in, like, a bad way necessarily, but, like, different in the sense that, like, I recognize this Roderick Strong on this show. He is basically the same Roderick Strong that I remember as, like, the PWG champion that I, you know, saw. The Roderick Strong from the first Shingo match a month before was, like, the early shaky Roderick who's not quite himself. He's not doing the backbreakers. In this match, he's even hitting the backbreakers. The finishing stretch run, like, the sequence of stuff that he does to finish out the match was, like, that's exactly the Roddy sequence that you see in almost every match. Like, it was move for move, you know, and it's just, like, how did he go in a month? In 1 month, he, like, became the Roddy that we still see on TV to this day. I thought this match was great. I thought that, like, there was a ton of cool stuff. The corner spot that Matt, you mentioned with the DDT, as he was setting that up, Prazak is like, he might be setting him up for another low blow. And then Shingo goes out to the floor and grabs a chair. And it's like, in my head, I'm like, oh my God, he's going to murder his nuts with a chair. Because Prezak put that thought in my head. So, but then he does the DDT, which is brutal. But it would have been more brutal if I wasn't expecting him to just full force blast him in the nuts. So I was just like, he's going to fucking kill this guy. We'll never him and Marina will never have babies. I was going to spit the cereal out. You know that this guy will never impregnate an UFC fighter. Yeah, like the fact that like these guys kind of epitomize the concept that you hear people say of the power junior, and you see them here in these two matches, like the first match and then this match, like the way that they kind of were the progenitors of the style that has become so popular, but the way that their careers have kind of like mirrored each other in a weird way, not just their career. I was thinking this and I thought it in my head earlier and then I was like, is it their careers really? But it is, because it's also like their physicality. The fact that at this point they both were like trying to like, you know, bulk max to have something to prove, like, oh, we're strong, so we're big. But they've like both leaned out over the last few years and have like really become even better by being leaner. And it's just like, you guys never needed to be carrying around all this extra weight because you're like better now at the slimmer, even though you're like still just as strong. You're still just, you know, as small. And like Ronnie is like, you know, a top, one of the best workers on American TV in AEW. Shingo is a top, one of the best workers in, you know, Japan, in New Japan. And just the fact that these guys like were really putting it together here against each other in just very similar ways. And the way, like I said, the way that their careers have mirrored each other, blah, blah, blah. It's very exciting. But yeah, the fact that like watching a match from a month before this and then watching this match here, it's like that's fully foam Roderick Strong. Shingo was about the same, but like Roddy went from like, who is this guy, to that's Roddy. That's exactly how he is for the next 15 years, basically.
I really like this match a lot less than both you guys. I did not hate this match, but first off, I thought putting this match right after the last match, like Matt, you kind of mentioned, it didn't do it any favors, I thought, because, you know, the last match was full of violence and hate, and this was also supposed to be a hated issue with, like, basically a no DQ match. And, you know, Shingo literally cost Roddy a chance to reclaim the tag titles the night before when he did a rare for Ring of Honor run-in at the end of a match that led to a finish. This didn't feel like a big epic payoff. Instead, it just felt like a standard mid-card match to me where they occasionally use the chair to try and justify the stip. And the stip itself is weird, too, because, you know, they're trying to sell the idea that, you know, the FIP gimmick, which is, for those who don't know, one of FIP's differentiating things at the time that made it different from Ring of Honor was the wrestlers book themselves. They make the matches. They make their own rules. And so the FIP titles kind of becoming that. But they also just did a promo before, you know, on the video wire before the show where Ryan was like, you know, the FIP title also now will have a 20 count on the floor. So they're trying to do this no DQ match where they're brawling and using chairs, but they're also still doing the 20 count, which is always when you do the count but no DQ, that's always kind of a weird mix to me. I always feel like if you're doing no DQ, you should probably do no count out. That's just a weird thing I have, a weird nitpick I have a thing. But the thing that bugged me is the thing that you liked, which is this was entire feud was about tables. They set up the idea of a table in the promo right before the match, and no one goes through a fucking table in this match. Not even close. Like at one point Shingo goes on the apron and with Rai to like briefly tease it, but then Roddy quickly fights it off, and not only do they not use a table, they never even tease it for the rest of the match. They just keep going back to the chair. I thought the action was fine. I just thought there was a real lack of flow. It was very my move, your move in a way I don't like, where the transitions were very abrupt. I never felt like the weight or significance of what happened seconds before at any point in the match. Like, I thought it was fine. I did think there was an unintentionally funny moment where Shingo does a spot he's done before in Ring of Honor where he tells the ref to look elsewhere and he kicks his opponent in the balls. And then he does that, gets away with it. But then later he tells the ref to look elsewhere again. And I don't know if the ref either did it very quickly and turned back or didn't know that Shingo was telling him that and didn't do it at all because the camera doesn't quite catch it. But either way, it results in a spot where Shingo stomps Ronnie in the balls. And then with the ref like watching him the whole time, Shingo just, with no one around him, grabs his own balls and drops to his feet, and the ref just like watch him like, okay. I thought this match was slightly above average because I thought the DDT on the chair on the open chair was cool. I thought Roddy was working hard. I thought the action was fine enough. I don't think it overstayed its welcome. But considering that this was like a rematch and they were really built it up a little bit for by the standards of like a Ring of Honor mid-card match and they didn't pay off the goddamn table, I actually was disappointed by this. But
yeah, and I respect all of your critiques, except I really do feel strongly differently about the table thing. I think whenever wrestling tries to subvert people's expectations, it's usually through some kind of like dumb, illogical swerve. And this time it's just like, yeah, we're building up this table, but we're going to give you something exciting in a different way. And, you know, whether or not that worked, I guess I could say is in the eye of the beholder. But I appreciate that they tried that, that they were like, this guy likes tables, so he's not going to get to use one.
You're a little more flexible than Shingle. You love table, but you also love no tables. So
that's right. I love no tables.
That brings us to the ROH World Tag Team Title Match. Christopher Daniels and Matt Sydal defeated the Kings of Wrestling, Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli, in 22 minutes, 45 seconds when Sydal pinned Claudio after a Hurricane Rana. The tag titles did change hands, which you would never know if you just bought the DVD, because it's not like it was called Dethroned. It had a pictures of these two teams on the cover, spoiling the result of this match.
One of the teams was called the Kings of Wrestling, don't forget. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, exactly. But Tim, what do you think about this? Obviously, the namesake of the show, big title change.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it wasn't like it was, you know, be impossible. You could, like, you know, call it something like, you know, the Angel's Throne. You could play off like Sydal seeming similar to like Citadel. You could have done something like that. Like, you know, like the God Citadel, anything else other than Dethroned, and show a picture of the Kings, you know, losing the tag team titles
I would have called it the Lords and the Kings, because it sounds like Lord of the Rings, and you got both teams, and yeah, that's what I would have called it.
Yeah, that would have been much better name, and it wouldn't have predicted the finish. But you know, whatever. They also, I think that there was like, because you did the video wire with Roderick Strong on the last episode, and I think like there was already a video wire out where they were like, we're going to show you, you know, the tag team titles changing hands. Like, there was already a video wire out that had footage of the tag team titles changing hands. So, like, this was pretty much out there. There is Allison Dangerous in the cheerleader outfit again. And you guys kind of mentioned that on the last podcast, how it's just like she's just a cheerleader for some reason. It doesn't necessarily make sense. And I do think it plays into, like, Christopher Daniels here, which is that, like, what? It's been years since the prophecy was a thing, right? In ROH, in general, I guess.
Yeah, I would say getting close to 3 years at this point, yeah.
But is there any difference between prophecy Christopher Daniels and this Christopher Daniels? Like, really? You know, it's just like,
in terms of his matches being interesting, I would say yes.
Sure, but like his swagger, his presentation, who he is as a character, right? Like, there's just nothing, there's no fucking difference. So it's just like, why isn't the prophecy still just a thing? Like, it's like, who is this fucking guy? And shit is like, and this is honestly maybe the most interesting that he can be, because you're clearly trying to use him in this role to get Matt Sydal over, and it works. By the end of this match, you guys were talking about, like, subverting expectations. This was, like, it's interesting because the previous match subverted the expectation with the table. I thought that they did a really good job on the finish here. And I put it in my notes where I was just like, this finish feels very much like a Christopher Daniels, Chris Hero finish. Because I know both of these guys love doing, like, finishes that subvert the expectations, right? But I almost am like, do I even know that about Chris Hero at this point? Is this like a Chris Hero thing in 2016 or 2006? Or is this like something that probably Daniels actually taught Hero to appreciate more? Because, like, it's, you know, Chris Hero has had a long and winding career with a lot of different ways. But, like, the way that the finish, like, actually was executed was, like, it was done really well. And there was a ton of stuff in here that was swerves. And I've heard Chris Hero talk about, like, his, like what he enjoys in storytelling, even just move for move, psychology wise in matches. And he likes doing, like I said, like subverting what you expect, subverting momentum. That's why, like, one of his favorite things, and you can always see it once you know that it's a Chris Hero thing that he enjoys, is like the vertical suplex counter, where one guy is setting up the vertical suplex and the other guy just tosses the other guy over. Like, he loves that because it's like the epitome of subverting the expectation, right? And the finish kind of does that because you expect something big, you're doing a ton of like hot tags back and forth, blah blah blah, and then the finish is just Christopher Daniels shoves Chris Hero out of the way and Matt Sydal rolls it into a victory roll. And that's like, you would not expect that from everything that's happened in this match. And so that's why I'm like, was this like Daniels? Was this Daniels? And this is like the beginnings of Hero starting to enjoy this kind of stuff. And that's why I talk about, like, he's so fucking boring and it's so hard to even care about Daniels, but is he just so influential and he's really got this great mind. And again, in this setting, he's such a big part of this, is helping to put together a match that's structured really well, to where like the opening stuff is, you know, people like to throw around the like Southern tag match. And I think a lot of people just say that. And like, I don't necessarily know how much of that really means like a Southern tag structure or whatever, but like, there's just basic tag team psychology in here that makes a ton of sense. It was really refreshing, especially at this point, you know, in 2024, to watch something from back here and kind of expect something and then see like, oh, like this is like giving me a better version of what I would expect. It's like, it's actually building up my anticipation, because the first moment that Sydal and Claudio get in the ring together, I was like, oh, okay, these guys are going to be great together. They're going to do some crazy cool high spots because Sydal is this great flyer and Claudio is this amazing base. But the first time that they get in the ring together, they don't just give you that. They do a couple spots and then they break it down. It breaks down into a double teams and then tagging back and forth. And then Daniels gets back in. Daniels takes over, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually you start hitting those big, cool high spots, but you don't do that until Sydal's first big hot tag after the Heroes get the heat on Daniels, which they set up the heat off of like a pretty solid misdirect spot where he thinks he's got the pin on the illegal man, and then that's where they like kind of counter into them getting the heat, right? So it's like you put like a lot of psychology, really good storytelling, and you like build this up. And most of the storytelling is built around getting Sydal over. And that's why I talk about, like, Daniels is so fucking boring and I don't really care about him, but he's so smart. Like, he's meant to be a producer, a manager, whatever they fucking call it, not a manager. Yeah, like a producer, like a putting matches together and helping people understand this stuff. Because it's almost like in here I'm seeing Daniels, like, imparting and delivering, like, this thought process that helps build Chris Hero into being one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. And like, you know, these guys all give credit to Daniels, old man Daniels, and how smart he is, but you don't really think about it as much, like, you know, how good he really is. And I'm talking a bunch. There's a ton of great stuff here. There's some really cool spots. I even just like something as stupid as Hero giving the big kiss goodbye to the title match in the beginning before he loses. Gabe playing off of the previous show, talking about the trash bag, the yellow trash bag. He's like, yeah, well, for some reason tonight he's got the red trash bag. You know, like, there's a ton of great stuff here. Gabe is hitting over the top, talking about the 5-year anniversary. I love when like the stuff mirrors and the details like play up against each other. But I hate when the commentary is telling me that, like, oh, well, on the first show, Christopher Daniels refused to shake hands, but on the 100th show, he chose to shake hands, right? And it's like, okay, like, cool. I don't want you to tell me that.
That's Gabe's whole thing. That's what Gabe does, yeah, on commentary. Like, that's his thing.
Yeah, he can't leave the subtext. And then he does the same thing later on where he's like, oh, well, you know, Christopher Daniels, he's been there since the start, and he was actually the first tag team champion. And can you imagine if the first tag team champion was defending the tag team titles on the 5th anniversary that's coming up? And it's just, come on, man. I don't want the commentary telling me this. But anyways, like I said, I've already said, I've been talking way too long. Trevor, I don't know who you want to talk next, but those are my thoughts. And there's not a ton to it. There is a ton to it, but it's not coherent. Can one of you guys like draw a box around all of that and make it make sense?
I'm not gonna edit that if that's what you're trying to say, but
No, not that.
I would say there was a boring Christopher Daniels match fighting to be heard here, but the entertainment of the other three guys won out. Now that might be a little harsh. I actually didn't think Daniels was terrible here, but there were definite parts in the body of the match where it did feel like a lot of his recent matches where it's very workmanlike, but kind of like you were saying, Tim, you know, really psychologically sound kind of smart wrestling, but like, you know, you could see he was putting some of the structure in there. You know, he ends up being the face in peril and all that. Although I really didn't like his face in peril. Like when you are the guy getting beat on for a long time, I feel like the longer you get beat on, the cooler you're like breaking away and come back to make the hot tag should be, because you know it should justify the long time we watch you just getting beat down. And here there's no real payoff. Like that he gets beat on for a while and then they just tease it, and then eventually he just STOs Claudio grabs his leg after Daniels just like kicks off like chew away, and then he makes the tag. And I thought, okay, that's a little like you could have come up with something a little cooler than that. But Daniels was fine in this match. But I thought what made this match, and I really enjoyed this match a fair bit, was Hero and Claudio and Sydal are all so good here, and not just so good, but Hero and Claudio are great at being bases for Sydal. Like they're really chocolate and peanut butter just mixing together well here. Sydal in this match looks as good as maybe he has ever up to this point in Ring of Honor. Like they do a few different Ranas with him doing it them to Hero and Claudio, and they all are just so good looking. Like, but then there's the standout spot, which is this match. Like it's kind of notable because it's a tag title change, but people don't remember this match. But this is a spot, it's stuck in my head for like the bajillion years it's been since I watched this match, like well over a decade and a half. I still remember this spot because it was one of the coolest things I've ever seen, and he's done it since then. But when Sydal jumps, does a vertical leap, he stands on Claudio's shoulders, and then he jumps off of Claudio's shoulders and drops down into a midair DDT. And the fans, which we've talked about, these fans were often kind of terrible, lose their shit and give a standing ovation for it. It's to this day one of the coolest spots I've seen in wrestling ever. To me, it's one of the more, in terms of like, there are spots that mean more to me in wrestling because they have like emotion and significance by them and character stuff. But in terms of just eye candy spots, that might be my second favorite spot other than the DDT Rey Mysterio does to Eddie Guerrero at Halloween Havoc 97 where he springboards off the ropes and basically like moonsaults into a picture perfect DDT on the way down. I think it's just beautiful. Like watch this spot, watch Claudio even just subtly, well not subtly, but like you don't notice the first time you watch because you're just watching Sydal. Watch Claudio grab Sydal's calves a bit when he stands on Claudio's shoulders just to help him out. Like that's the kind of stuff that makes you a great base and pulls off these spots. And then
Do you remember you have to have seen the spot where it's like very similar, but it's quack and then he falls down into the Yoshi tonic.
I mean, that's really cool too. I feel like this was the first one of those I had seen. And once it's almost like you can't repeat the magic of seeing it the first time, even when you do like in some ways a cooler variation. But I get that too. But I would say this is a match with three crazy standout spots where you have that spot, but then you have a great spot where Claudio, he tries to hit Daniels with the Doomsday Device, European uppercut. Daniels victory rolls Hero to dodge it for a near fall. The crowd pops big for. And it was like at that point in the match where I was like, between that and the other spot, I was like, man, they missed the peak here because both those spots were like incredible. They both would have been great ways to end the match. And then they proved me wrong because I actually think the finish was a spot that lives up to it. I think it's the second coolest spot of the match where Hero and Claudio are going to do the KRS-One to Sydal. And as they flip him in midair, Sydal keeps flipping, lands in a Rana and a picture perfect Rana and pins Claudio with it. I thought that was like, I was like, okay, great. You did not miss the peak. That was an incredible spot. Hiro, as usual, helps brighten the more sedate parts of the match, like with his personality, which I've talked about a lot recently. Like, at one point, he's calling himself Dominique Wilkins. At one point, he's just randomly screaming, "Excellence!" before he does the leapfrog. There's a moment where he crawls on top of Claudio outside the ring, and I love that he feels the need to tell Claudio, "I'm protecting you," when he climbs on top of him. Like, just climbing on top of him isn't enough. Hiro even busts out like a twisting dive to the floor. And I feel like this is a match where, apart from Daniels, it really felt like a match where the other three guys were all pulling out stops and doing things they normally wouldn't do, or maybe even just some things they normally couldn't do, because Seidel usually wasn't working with two giant bases as good as Hiro and Claudio, and Claudio and Hiro probably aren't always working with a high flyer as smooth as Matt Seidel is. I thought this match was like very good, like 3¾ stars. You know, there were, you know, again, there's some more kind of meh, boring parts, but like those great spots are just super memorable, eye candy, oh my god, holding up 18 years later spots, and I really enjoyed it. Matt, what'd you think?
I'd say in terms of star rating, you and I are pretty much right on the same. We're in the hand-holding club, as they would say on Doughboys.
Yay.
We have to say, I would say. And, you know, I agree, like, there were some spots early that maybe, like you said, like the boring Daniels match trying to escape, and that took it down a little bit, and then those final few minutes being pretty awesome. One thing that I would say is one of my biggest surprise memory, like, you know, things that I didn't remember, I guess, about 2006 ROH, was just how heavily featured Matt Seidel was throughout basically the entire year. Like, Gabe, from like day one of that first show, keeps putting him in these really important spots and gives him all these chances to shine. And you said you think this was his best performance of the year. I think you might be right. There's still a couple of like that first AJ Styles match at Hell Freezes Over. I really love that match too, and his performance in that. But this is right up there. And, you know, you mentioned all the spots, so I don't need to do that. But it was funny on more good commentary stuff. First of all, speaking of talking about the 5 years and, like, Daniels being, you know, champion 5 years later, Gabe also just sorts of rambles. Like, he talks about how, like, Paul London wrestled Michael Shane at Uncensored and proved he would be a star in this business. And it's like, first of all, like, where did that come from? Like, what does that have to do with anything? And second of all, like, this was 2006. I feel like, you know, I think it was Paul London. This was during the era where London and Kendrick were in the tag team, right? Was that 2006?
I think so.
Yeah, and like, I don't know. London's WWE run was already, I'd say, very disappointing. Not his fault.
Killed his love of pro wrestling.
Right. He was only like 6 months away from being fired for good, right? For smiling during that stupid Vince McMahon angle. But the other thing that Gabe did on commentary was, you know, continue to talk shit about Hiro. And then Prazak said, all four men could be described as great athletes. And Gabe responds, I'll agree on three. And I'm wondering at this point, like, how much of that do you think was still Gabe's sincere feelings about Chris Hiro? Like, that he just was not completely sold on him. And how much of him was, like, playing into the gimmick? Like the kayfabe. I honestly am not sure even to this day. I know, because I mentioned this before, that on a shoot interview after Gabe left ROH, he expressed disappointment that Hiro became a serious ass kicker after he left. And while he was there, Hiro insisted on being like a more of that goofball type. Like he wanted the serious Hiro and didn't like all the shenanigans. So I do think there's probably some sincerity to it. The other thing that I would say stood out to me about this match, this was after watching the last two Kings of Wrestling against Aries and Strong matches on Bitter End and Black Friday Fallout, it's like Kings of Wrestling had flipped a switch and they were just finally starting to hit their stride in ROH of like doing these hot athletic matches. Because if, you know, if you've been listening to the show, you know that we've complained about Claudio not showing what he could really do for a long time as a heel. And their matches being very shticky, but then like the night before, they had a pretty exciting match against Aries and Strong. And then on this show, they really, you know, turned it on as far as like the high spots and like the basing for Seidel and doing a lot of cool stuff and fast pace. And they get a couple more chances to do that. And then they're broken up. Like, I understand why they took the belts off of them here, because they thought Claudio was leaving. But by the time they get to final battle and the team breaks up, they knew that he wasn't. So I'm like, if they were just starting to have all these awesome matches, why are you breaking them up? Still doesn't make sense to me to this day, because I don't think that Claudio versus Hiro feud really lit the world on fire. So it feels like, and you know, and then once the team got back together a couple of years later under the different booking regime, they were, I'd say, even better. So I think it was a mistake that they were kind of hurtling toward the end of the Kings of Wrestling here, especially once they realized that that Claudio was going to stay.
Yeah, and even though I don't have it in my notes, I do think it's been said somewhere that, like, yeah, we did not, you know, Gabe did not intend to have the Kings of Wrestling drop the titles this quickly, but obviously because, like you said, Matt, they all of a sudden thought, oh, Claudio's about to leave. He was going to sign a deal with WWE. And so that is one of the criticisms you could give this match is, as cool as the match is, it is kind of sad of like, it does feel like the Kings are just getting rolling in Ring of Honor as a team. And also, like, this doesn't feel like some big long-running feud, like some really epic end to a long title reign. You know, it feels like what it is in that sense, which is it's a title change they have to do because someone is apparently leaving. But as a match, I thought it was a very enjoyable match.
Can I ask you a question about kind of what you were saying there about Seidel and how much you appreciated his other performances?
Sure.
Which I will not argue with you about it, but I do want to ask, because kind of my takeaway from it, as I was talking about the way that Daniels, I would assume Daniels put this match together. Would you agree with my feeling that this was maybe not his best performance, but it did feel like the peak of creating Matt Seidel as a star? And especially making the most out of something like winning a tag team title as feeling like a major achievement in making someone into something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because he's been trying to go for those tag team titles with different partners, right? And, like, he was able to achieve it. You know, he always got to the cusp. You know, he lost to AJ. He lost to Strong and Aries. He lost to Kenta. He lost to Delirious in the Survival of the Fittest Finals. And finally, he has the big achievement close to the end of the year. He actually wins the big one, so to speak. So absolutely, I would agree with that.
Yeah, and not just that he finally wins, but like you were saying, like there's a lot of like stuff there, and even though it's a tag team title, it really did feel like he achieved this victory. Like, you know, you can say whatever you want about Daniels, but he did a good job of not really hogging any of the limelight
and
producing a match where it felt like Seidel was the star and the reason why they won.
Yeah, Daniels is definitely not a selfish wrestler. Like, you cannot say that about him at all. Like, he was in this to make Matt Seidel. And, I think he came as close as he could have to succeeding.
Yeah, like, if you watch, I mean, if we just break down the match again, I mean, Daniels, the veteran who's, the, you know, the star on TNA TV at this point, he's the one who's the face in peril, not young Seidel. He's the one making the hot tag and then letting Seidel do the big, you know, come in and run wild, you know. He's, you know, when it's time for who's going to win the championship, it's Seidel who scores the win. He's just holding a guy back. So, yeah, like they structured this match where basically everything was built around Seidel getting to be the one that looks cool and Daniels being the guy that kind of does the boring parts of the match, which he had gotten really good at the boring parts of the match. But, like, I think to your point, Jimmy, it was in this match, it was like by design that, like, you're going to get to do all the cool parts. You're getting all the cream here. And, he did.
And then the one spot that didn't get mentioned that I thought was sick as fuck was Seidel looking for a shooting star press and Claudio catches him with a European uppercut. That was like the one spot that no one mentioned that I thought was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, there's two or three I left out. There's, you know, again, if you just like cool stuff that still holds up, this is the match on the show to watch. It's really good for that. After the match, the crowd gives a big round of applause. They chant "New fucking champs." The Kings of Wrestling leave, and then the fans briefly chant "Don't come back" at them. Daniels gets on the mic and he says, "It looks like we are the champions," playing off of the choice of theme music that the Kings did. If you didn't know at the time, they were using "We Are the Champions" by Queen. And then he goes, "The belts are back in the hands of people who respect this company." The fans chant ROH. And then Daniels says he knows they're only as good as the challengers they beat. And so he's saying that the belts are on the line to any team at any time. And that's the gospel according to the Lords of the Ring. Matt, oh my God. I thought that one promo we saw a few shows ago was the only time he tried to make this thing a name. He was really trying to make this a name.
Well, it would have worked if they went full like Dusty Rhodes doing Oz with it. Like have them come out to the ring with little hobbits and a wizard, right? Like that, you know, maybe Alice in Danger could have dressed up as like, I don't know, Arwen or something. You know, just go full on with it.
And then ROH shows a rare instant replay of the finish of this match, and then they would actually show a few more instant replays for the main event. So it's always interesting when Ring of Honor, like randomly out of nowhere, just decides, one show, we might as well, we'll break out some instant replays, and then we won't do it for a long time.
It's so hard, and like I say this as somebody who does a podcast, like it's so hard to like make new things stick. Like even like early on, like I forgot to do the Medvedev trophy one time, right? Like it's so like, yeah. It's like you see these companies, even like you know AEW does this sometimes where they'll like they'll bring in some sort of new element to the show and then just be like forget it. like let's just do what we're doing already. Like that's sort of what I think of when ROH does like new stuff like this.
They bring back the rankings and then forget them for the few weeks right after they announce they're bringing them back. Right. Yeah, it's just like oh God, it's hard to form habits. Yeah, exactly. So now it's time for intermission.
Yeah, this is like sticking to a diet or going to the gym, you know? It's the whole point is habit forming.
Mm-hmm. So now it's time for intermission. We join Gary Michael Capetta backstage, and he's with the Briscoe brothers. Jake congratulates Sy Dallan Daniels on winning the tag titles, but he says that makes them nothing but targets now. Mark says they have a street fight tonight. He and Jay start yelling to the camera awesomely, and Mark shows his big front tooth gap, which they, Ring of Honor, loved when that tooth gap was new. And I love Mark. He goes, you know, not two more teeth out of my head. You know, I don't care. And he's just very aggressive about this. So, you know, Davey Richards was the big dumb promo, and the dumbness not working to your benefit. The Briscoes were the masters of the big dumb promo. Absolute, where the dumbness absolutely worked to your benefit, and that was enjoyable. But next up, back from intermission, we have Nigel McGuinness defeating Jimmy Ray via pinfall in 19 minutes, 28 seconds after he hits the rebound lariat. And I thought, unfortunately, this match was a lot like Jimmy Rave's match against Homicide the night before. It's another match on Rave's first weekend of this relaunched character and relaunched push where we have another high on the card singles match for him where he's facing a top star in Ring of Honor. You know, the night before it was Homicide. This night it's Nigel McGuinness. And we have another match that's really long. It's pretty slow. There's a ton of mat work that doesn't really have a payoff. I did enjoy the mat work here more than the Homicide match. It felt somewhat more focused on the arm. It still was not exactly thrilling. It took up more than half the match, if not more, and did not really have a payoff. I thought the best thing about it was at one point, Rave, in the middle of the match, makes a point to take the elbow pads off his good arm and put them on his injured arm. And that's one of those kinds of like little attention to detail, smaller things that Rave can really flash sometimes that I appreciate about him. But again, then it doesn't, there's no real payoff to the rest of the match, to the arm work. And then the action comes in and it's fine. But even there, like in the final few minutes, they're doing the brawling at ringside that kind of feels like what you would normally see, that level of brawling at ringside in the first few minutes of most other matches rather than the last few. And then I realized, oh, it's just because they wanted to do that one spot where Nigel gets thrown back into the ring, but instead of going into the ring, he bounces off the ropes and then does like a rebound lariat on the floor, which is a neat spot. But, you know, I feel like they did all that just to get to there. And this match doesn't feel nearly as big in the final minutes of a nearly 20-minute match as you'd want it to. Another negative I had with this match was Nigel's style at this point was just to spam a lot of finishers, and a lot of times he had the Tower of London and the rebound lariat, and even occasionally the lariat off the second turnbuckle, and you know he would often do those finishers multiple times in the match, sometimes all of them multiple times in the match, and the negative of that, you know, sometimes that could be really exciting, but the negative of that in a match like this was he only hit one rebound lariat, and it felt kind of like, oh, that's it? That's all it took? Where I should never feel that way. When a guy hits his finisher, I should be like, that's enough. But it's almost like I'm starting to grow a little numb where I'm like, in a long match, I want to see Nigel hit like four finishers, which is kind of just a side effect of how he has started to work. overall, I'd call this a very average match. I would say it's a little better than what I thought was a really disappointing match against Homicide the night before. But I thought this was like a really disappointing weekend for Rave's relaunch. He was just too measured and methodical for me. And I know methodical and measured is Rave's thing, and it's often his strength. But here I thought on this weekend he went a little too far in that way. I just wish he had shown a little more urgency, a little more new things in this match. And I do get that this was the start of a feud with Nigel. They'll shoot an angle for it after the match. And a lot of times when you know you're starting a feud with somebody, you hold a lot back because you know, hey, we're going to be wrestling 2, 3, 4 more times. But I felt like even in the context of that, they could have given a little bit more here. But maybe I'm just cranky. I don't know. Tim, what did you think about this?
Well, I did. My first thing that I wanted to reference, which is funny because Matt called it the straddle lariat on the last episode, and I think that that Trevor, you kind of you co-signed that concept. The lariat where the person is like, you know, strung in on the top rope on their crotch, and he comes off the middle rope with the lariat. I've always heard that called the pendulum lariat. But
that's what I always thought the rebound lariat was the pendulum lariat, because he swings like a pendulum.
No, yeah, the pendulum. I've always heard the pendulum called the one that I'm talking about, where the person is straddled on the top, and then the rebound lariat is called the rebound, or now people call it the Nigel, right, or the wacky line.
Well, they actually renamed it later on the jawbreaker lariat for Nigel after he breaks Jimmy Rave's jaw in another match. Yeah.
But the one on the top, I had heard that referred to as the pendulum lariat. But either way, that's not really the point, because he doesn't actually hit it in this match. So I was like, oh, I'm going to mention the pendulum lariat, and he doesn't hit it. He does attempt it, but Rave gets out of the way. But another, like, related to that kind of concept, especially based off of what you just said, Trevor, like, he does hit the outside variation of the rebound, you know, jawbreaker lariat on the outside.
Yeah, so I guess he does do two.
Yeah, because he does the one where he bounces. Yeah. And I actually think that one is better than the real one, because the Nigel, you know, the rebound lariat inside the ring, I fucking hate it. I think it's really dumb. And, like, I hate that it poisons wrestlers who I like Kyle O'Reilly, doing it too.
Phil Schneider also really hates that move, according to his appearance on this show.
Sure. But, you know, that's, I guess, one thing that me and Phil Schneider agree on. There's that's it. Otherwise, you know, I think. Anyway, so he did hit two versions of that. He also hit the London Dungeon, which is like a previous Nigel finisher. So, you know, when you're saying like, oh, he didn't hit enough finishers, right? He did. He hit a lot of the Nigel finishers. The Tower of London.
Right,
not
Tower,
the London
Tower
Dungeon.
Of London.
He hit the Tower.
London Dungeon, I think, was like an arm submission that he did later on.
Yeah, he never did that in this match. Yeah, so I was talking about the Tower of London, unfortunately. I misspoke. But the biggest thing about this match was the opening stuff was fun, and I think that the crowd, similar to what I was talking about earlier with like the Delirious and Jason Blade thing, the crowd didn't know who was heel but who was babyface, and they did a really bad job of trying to tell you what's going on early on, until Nigel just starts to do things that are like physically fucked up and hitting nasty fucking big ass lariats and strikes. And then now the crowd is like into it. He does like the hammerlock hold. Like, once he gets the crowd invested by hitting these just big fucking sick strikes, and now they're into it.
And then bend back arm thing that he does, that they got into that one too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, once he did the big strikes, now the crowd's into it, and then he does the bend back arm thing, and he does the holding suspended hammerlock, and now the crowd's into it. Okay, yeah, we're awake. But in the beginning, they were not awake, and I don't blame them completely, because this match was presented as kind of like, I don't know who the fuck I'm supposed to be into. And you guys talked about it with the show previously, where Rave was like in a match, and they're trying to relaunch him, but they're not making it clear like who he's supposed to be, what his like vibe is. And then you're here with Nigel, and Nigel has always been kind of iffy. It feels like the crowd is supposed to like him, But at times he's like still a fucking cunt and you don't necessarily know that you like him a ton. But then once they get him into it with the nasty striking and the violence, then it's like, okay, Rave hits the STO on the apron, which is a signature spot for him that he continues to do, you know, up until the end of his, the tragic, you know, end of his career. And the crowd pops huge for that. You know, it's loud, it's nasty, it's violent. And it's like, okay, they're into it when it's violent. And it's one of those things that, that kind of sucks because I've always said and thought that Nigel leaned into this stuff when he didn't need to because he was such a great wrestler and he did not need to give himself brain damage and basically end his career earlier than he needed to based on that. But when you see the way the crowd reacts to his match here, it almost feels like they were incentivizing him to do it. And it really fucking sucks because it's just like, yeah, like he was such a great wrestler. He was so incredibly talented, but this crowd really didn't come alive until he started, like I said, giving himself brain damage or giving Jimmy Rave brain damage. And just, and all of his strikes are just so, they just pop. They're loud. There's no way not to be into them, but like, these guys are so, again, both so incredibly talented, but it's just like, it's the crowd doesn't really give them anything until it becomes viscerally aggressive that way. And then the post-match, where it's like, you know, Nigel is like, this guy's not a piece of shit, he's a good guy, yeah. he's going to shake my hand.
Yeah. It's a
yeah,
thing.
And then, and then, you know, obviously after that, but... Okay, well, I guess, Matt, if you want to talk about the match,
yeah,
and then we can talk about the post-match. But there is also something else that I want to bring up that's related to this, and I think it's the perfect time to bring this up, as a hanging Chad from the last episode. But, Matt, do you want to talk about the match?
Yeah. First of all, I will mention that whole thing about how the crowd incentivizes Nigel to give himself brain damage. Like, that becomes a big part of his character a year from this, right? When he turns heel, like about the crowds egging him on and him resenting them and all that stuff. So, you know, that's that he was well aware of that, I think.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I like the homicide rave match a little more than Trevor did. I like this match a lot more than Trevor did. And I think it sounds, Tim, like you like this match more than Trevor did. Based on what you were saying.
Oh yeah. I really like this.
Yeah.
I think that this match was failed more by the crowd than it was their performances, but I thought this was great.
Yeah, yeah. I think like I was very honestly like, you know, I respect Trevor, like your difference of opinion. I was definitely surprised that you said they didn't do enough though, because it felt like they were trying to have a show stealer. Like it felt like they were just going for it. Like especially once like the match got going halfway through, you know, like Rave hit that sick STO on the apron, you know, Nigel with his hard hitting lariats. Like, yeah, the crowd was a little weak for it early, including like an awkward silence chant, but they got into it to a point by the end, I would say. And like, they were just throwing bombs and I couldn't believe it. Like, I guess what I would say is if the match was a little faster paced and had a hotter crowd, I think it would be pretty well remembered as like a gem, you know, like it's so physical. And I do like that. I see like Rave becoming like, you know, I mean, he was great at the cheating and the stalling and he will be again, but I like that he's trying to do something a little more action oriented at this point, like just less stalling, less cheating, you know, just trying to have matches, but still kind of being it, you know. It's just like, I appreciate that he wanted to do something different and he is doing something different. And I thought this was Rave's best match in a long time. Maybe even his best singles match probably since the Danielson match in the same building at the 4th anniversary show. And I thought it was a good sequence for Nigel. It made me want to see more of these two. I thought this was very, very, very good.
See, I think this is a weirdly divisive match because, like, this was one of those matches where I was like, am I underrating this? So I, like, looked up the reviews, which I normally don't do. I do occasionally if I'm curious, but only after I've kind of written my own review for my notes. But, like, I was like, what did people think about this match? And I found a review that gave it 2.5, one that gave it 2.25, one that gave it 2.75, one that gave it 3 stars, and one that gave it 3.75 stars. So, like, it's basically all over the place, like, you know, from average to maybe a little below average to good to almost great to you guys seem on like the high end, and I'm closer to the low end. So this is a match where it feels like, depending on what you kind of value, or although as Tim just blatantly embarrassed me, I apparently did not even notice the amount of finishers that occurred in the match. But I could see why other people, because one thing I will say about this is, even when this match didn't thrill me, it is the match where it's a very solid match, right? It's like a better version of like a Christopher Daniels match to me, where like these are professional ass wrestlers, you know? And
these guys are so much. Go ahead.
I was just saying, I remember their match at Final Battle being even better, but I guess we'll see.
So, I was going to say, it's interesting when you compare this to the next match, because it's like two guys who are bigger and more physical having like a really like ass-kicking match compared to two guys who are smaller and like, you know, a little bit less in that regard. And that match gets such a better reaction.
Yeah. So we'll get to after the match. Nigel waits for Jimmy to recover, and he looks for a handshake, but Jimmy wants to leave without one. Nigel tells him, like, wait. He grabs a mic. Nigel gets on the mic and says, hey, you know, in the past, I didn't think that you deserved to be in this ring. I thought you were just a joke and that you and the embassy was just old school shtick. But he goes, after tonight, I respect you. I think you've earned the right to stand in this ring as much as me or anyone in the back for Ring of Honor. He goes, you know, hey, so how about you shake my hand, and then you, Jimmy, you can move on to this next stage of your career that you're getting into. The fans chant, shake his hand. And Rave actually does, like, shake his hand with no turn or anything like that. Rave, like, when the crowd afterwards is like claps for them doing that, Rave actually like acknowledges the crowd afterwards, is like the most babyface thing he's probably done since his heel turn years earlier. And as they applaud, Nigel grabs a roll of toilet paper, which I don't know where he got it from ringside, because again,
he got it off the announcer's table.
Yeah, you're not supposed to have.
I watched it.
Well, I think there must have been a gimmick where a fan tried to throw it and they confiscated it just so they could have it there. I'm sure that's what happened, actually.
Yeah, because for those who didn't watch the show, remember.
He goes and reaches over and onto where the announcers are on the table at the side, or like the timekeepers or whatever, and that's where he pulls it from.
Yeah, because
you can actually see where he gets it.
Yeah. For those who weren't keeping up with this, this was the first weekend where Ring of Honor actually like banned toilet paper. You could not throw it at Jimmy Rave anymore. So yeah, there was still somehow they maybe, like Matt said, they found a way to like set up, have a reason for a roll of toilet paper, like you said, Tim, on the table for Nigel to grab. So he throws it at Jimmy. Crowd laughs it because, you know, whatever. And Jimmy then gets really pissed off. He slaps Nigel, goes, you know, what the fuck your problem is. They get into this, you know, argument in the ring where Nigel's telling Jimmy, like, you know, if you ever hit me like that again, I'll knock you the fuck out. Jimmy just calls him a piece of shit. He goes, you know, the toilet paper stuff isn't fun anymore. They throw a ton of F-bombs at each other as they have this really intense standoff. Finally, Christopher Daniels runs into the ring. He gets between them. He's trying to play peacemaker. He tells them, you know, cut it out. Jimmy says, Nigel's a joke. He walks to the back. He's getting some booze for this. The camera follows him back to the curtain, and we get a classic old-school ROH segment done in almost complete darkness because there's no lighting backstage. We can hear Rave angrily tell someone, presumably Gabe, you know, I don't understand Nigel's problem. Nigel thinks I'm a ha-ha joke, Jimmy says. He thinks I'm a ha-ha joke, and I'm not a joke. Nigel and Daniels go to the back and start arguing a tiny bit again, and Rave has already grabbed his luggage. We can see him walking out of the building. Nigel trails behind him as Gabe and Daniels prevent him from following Jimmy. Gabe, and this is the moment where I alluded to earlier, where Gabe is in a baseball cap and a long leather jacket, and he looks hilariously like Paul Heyman. You have never seen Gabe Sapolsky look more like, because they don't have the same fashion sense. On this night, it was as if Gabe decided to cosplay as Paul Heyman for one night. So I'll say this. I'll say the standoff in the ring was decently intense, but this angle was not good to me because it combined a couple of things that we've sometimes seen in Ring of Honor that I really haven't liked in the past, which is one, and Tim, this is something you were talking about. It's a babyface acting like an asshole. And, you know, like Nigel in this segment is supposed to be the babyface. You know, he's been a babyface for a while now. Jimmy is supposed to be the heel. Nigel's a complete asshole. Like he's
the
very
crowd. The crowd was still on his side, though. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's sad, but like he's being a jerk. Like Jimmy doesn't want this. He like lures Jimmy into being, you know, giving this gracious moment. And then he does the one thing he knows Jimmy doesn't want to see anymore and makes him look like a chump again. And he's the baby face. And then the other part, obviously the bigger negative, is that it's yet another ROH worked shoot, because this is one of those weird angles that doesn't work if you don't view it as like a shoot, because one wrestler telling another wrestler he thinks he sucks is incredibly common in wrestling. And, you know, they'll just yell back and forth or punch each other. But clearly the way they were selling this and acting this out, they were trying to sell as like, no, this is a real argument, because it was much like lower voices, a lot more swearing. Daniel's coming in the ring where he's not involved with these guys, but clearly, you know, he's a locker room leader, you know, having them go backstage and get, you know, Gabe's usually is only on camera when they're trying to sell that something's real, quote unquote. And this idea that, you know, Jimmy Rave is really, you know, we're supposed to believe that Nigel really doesn't have respect for Jimmy, and that Jimmy is legitimately pissed off that, you know, Nigel is bringing up this old gimmick. And it's just, it was really cringy. It did not, again, I like some of the acting these two guys did, but I don't know. Matt, am I crazy? What do you think?
I thought Rave was phenomenal. When you talk about the acting, I thought Rave, I mean, I've always thought that Rave was incredible. I hate to talk about a man who's passed this way, but like, I, you know, when Rave was alive and, you know, doing his whole thing, and I'm sorry, Matt, because I just completely jumped in, Trevor was throwing to you, but no, either way, like, I still hold it in high regard, like, the times where Jimmy where Jimmy like messaged me asking like, hey, can you find this match for me? Can you do this and that? And like, I still hold that stuff as like important to me emotionally, just because of how high I hold him as a person, you know, or not as a performer, I should say, because whatever. And when he would message me, you know, and he's saying this and that or whatever, like all the hard times he was going through at times, like, I still just think of him as such a great performer, you know, and I just had a conversation with Eamon, you know, on Twitter about this, like, you know, people who create art are not good people. They're not even necessarily smart. They're not even intelligent. Some people are just able to do this stuff and it doesn't necessarily speak to them beyond just the things that they do. But in my mind, in the way that I interacted with Jimmy Rave, I always like really appreciated him and just thought that he was, you know, this incredible artist who did this really cool stuff. And even this, like you talked about, like the way that he was able to express the emotion here, it just felt so real and it was so raw. And it speaks to, again, like, you know, the Jimmy Rave that, you know, I personally actually interacted with, right? Is that, like, I knew that he was kind of a raw nerve. He was the kind of person who would get this kind of, this emotional, right? And so that is part of it. Like, it's not acting when you believe it, you know? And part of Jimmy Rave and part of what made him so great is that I really do believe that he did believe, he really was 100% emotionally invested in a ton of the stuff that he did. And that's not to say that, like, it's real, quote unquote, right? It's just to say that, like, he just got that invested in everything he did.
Matt, what'd you think about it?
No, that was, by the way, that was, you know, very nice of you to share, Tim. And I think that, you know, that definitely adds a lot of, insight. And I do think Rave was really good. I do also think that by trying to make it realistic, like, it sort of took you out of it in the sense of, like, you know, they stand there talking trash to each other for an awkwardly long time before Daniels comes out. I think maybe Daniels just missed his cue, but it's like, it doesn't make sense when you watch it, because it's like, in wrestling, guys just start fighting for much less than that. And it was weird. Yeah. It was weird that, like, they were just standing there, like, looking at each other, being like, why are you being such an asshole? Like, it's like, you just had, like, a match where you beat the shit out of each other. Seems logical that you would just start fighting again. But so, you know, maybe if Daniels was out quicker, that wouldn't have been an issue. But yeah, I don't like work shoots. I never do. I just think that they take me out of, like, I just want to be in the show. And, like, I don't want to be in watch a show where it's like everything is fake except for some things. I want to watch a show where everything is presented as being equally real. And so I was never going to love this. And, you know, you could tell that, like, it never really works, because in ROH, like, they do it once and then they're just sort of like, oh, let's just move away from this and get back to this being a wrestling angle, you know, like they did with Strong and Danielson the year before.
Yeah. I was about to say when you started that sentence, like that's the perfect comparison where it's like the same thing where they start something with like a work shoot and then they decide, you know what, let's just focus on them having good wrestling matches and we don't need to keep carrying this on. So Tim, I know you said earlier you had something that you wanted to pivot off of this. Did you get to that already?
Here's the thing, and I don't know if you guys remember this, but you guys mentioned on the last episode, or at least Trevor, you did. You talked about the Roderick Strong intro music. Or no, you actually were talking about the Jimmy Rave intro music having...
Yeah, the interview with the vampire.
Yeah. Yes, and you had your clip, which was, I think, Rickles saying, like, I just got a call from Baskin-Robbins. They're down to 3 flavors. And then Matt was supposed to have his movie quote, and I have mine. So, Matt, did you remember this? Do you have your movie quote that would be on your entrance music as a wrestler?
Oh, man. No. I got to say that I do not.
Okay.
I did not do my homework.
You said you would have it for this episode, but that's okay. You can have it for the next episode, and then you won't have it.
I gotta set a reminder like on my phone or something, like for like two days before the episode to come up with it.
But that was the only reason why I pivoted off of this, because it was Jimmy Rave's music that led to that statement.
See, but this is what happens when you have a guest that's actually a listener. They want to they want payoff to the things that we tease, Trevor.
No one would remember this.
I don't like being held accountable. This isn't a good feeling.
I'm the one being held accountable, Trevor, and I say it's good. You got to hold my feet to the fire so I don't fail you like I usually do.
Well, anyways, my random music quote would be from The Decline of Western Civilization. They were interviewing this UK punk girl on the street, and they were talking to her about like the punk scene, and she said, a lot of people, they just, you know, when they talk to them about punks, they just think that all of the punks are just a bunch of like dead brain and they're just glue sniffers. And then the interviewer says, yeah, well, do you sniff glue? And she says, yeah, well, I glue sniff. And that would be my intro to my music.
That's very good.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's funny to think, like, was this from the 70s, like that quote?
It was like the mid 70s, early 80s. It was the original Decline of Western Civilization documentary. So
it's funny to think about, you know, with punk, like how much like glue sniffing was part of like the thing. See, it's like, I feel like by the time I was growing up, like, I don't think sniffing glue was really a thing anymore. It's like, do people sniff glue at all anymore?
Right. Oh, I remember, because you can get real drugs now.
Yeah, I guess.
I remember as a kid when I got glue, it would be like saying, you know, like non-toxic or no fumes or something. And I was vaguely aware. Right. I was like, man, I really missed a generation. I was like, I came along too late, you know, because, I had this vague awareness that glue used to be something else, but it wasn't anymore. It's like the way people talk about Quaaludes, but for kids, that's what glue was, the Quaalude for children.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, like the big like moral panic that you would see on like the news magazine shows was like huffing paint, right? Like that, like huffing spray paint and stuff like that. Like that was, that replaced sniffing glue. I don't think people do that anymore either.
Yeah, in this area, it was, in some communities, it was more huffing gas.
Yeah,
that'd be the big thing. But from huffing gas to Davey Richards, that brings us to the semi-main event. Davey Richards defeated Austin Aries via submission in 17 minutes and 7 seconds when he made him tap out to a key lock. Matt, this was the semi-main event. This was, you know, the match that Davey didn't want to win. He needed to win. A rematch of a match they had, you know, just a couple months earlier. The guy gave him lots of time, a big spot, and the crowd is nearly completely silent for this. What'd you think about it?
Yeah, I don't think the crowd was completely silent. I think that it wasn't like they were like, you know, weren't great, but they were, I would say they were on the quiet side is what I would say. But like, okay, so I didn't really like the match that they had at Glory by Honor Night 1 that much. I definitely like this one more, like by a pretty good amount. I thought that they went for it more here, just like I thought that Rave and Nigel kind of went for it. It's funny to me, though, because, like, you know, these two, like, these baby face athletic contests used to be ROH's bread and butter. You know what I mean? Like, you know, when you think back to the first couple years of ROH, whether it's, you know, Danielson against Loki or Paul London against Danielson or Paul London against AJ Styles. It's like that used to be the thing that ROH did. And the last few times they tried it, it didn't really work anymore. Like if you got AJ against Aries from 2005 or AJ against Richards from Death Before Dishonor or Aries against Richards from Glory by Honor, like none of those matches really worked. They didn't get the crowd. And this one didn't totally either. I just think it like it plays dry, I guess, during this era. But I actually did like it. Like I thought maybe it could have used Aries being willing to heal it up a bit more and sell the arm a bit more. But I thought like the work was good. Like I thought that it was, you know, I mean, they had a very weak dueling chant at the beginning just to show how that the crowd was on the quiet side. But then there was a spot early on where Richards puts Aries in a head scissors and avoids the dropkick escape. And Gabe goes, Davey Richards knows all about not putting Austin Aries in a head scissors. And I was just like, he just put him in a head scissors. So I don't think he knows all about you. Just you were reacting to something he did after he put Austin Aries in a head scissors. And then Gabe also talks about how Aries has learned some veteran techniques since he first joined ROH. He'd been in ROH for about 2.5 years, and like it's weird for me to think about how in that era, like 2.5 years turned a wrestler from a newcomer into a veteran. But nowadays, people are in WWE developmental for like 3 times that long, like and yeah. Still considered newcomers when they come up to the main roster at age 40.
Bischoff will call a 40-something Tama Tonga like a young talent.
Yes.
Yeah, it's
thank
it's
you, weird. Trevor. That was exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, but it's like exactly right. I mean, you look at WWE roster, right? Like Damian Priest and guys like that. Again, like people in their 40s. Anyway, but you know, I thought that you know they didn't tell that much of a story, but like there was a little bit of one. It's like you know Aries sort of maybe like overly confident doing the like swinging elbow drop where he asked for the crowd's approval for long enough that Richards moves out of the way. And, you know, Richards does some of, like, his own mockery of Aries' crowd appeals. Aries does some mockery of Richards. He does his own little, like, handspring thing. At one point, Gabe, on commentary, he's talking about, like, Samoa Joe, Loki, and CM Punk are the only three wrestlers that have achieved, at this point, the status of ROH legends. And says Danielson, Homicide, and Aries are sort of people who, like, are on the cusp. And I was thinking, like, so really, at this point, he doesn't think that Danielson was an ROH legend, even though he was, like, in the first 2 main events and was the champion for over a year at this point. I thought that was interesting. I also wonder when the Briscoes crossed that Rubicon in Gabe's mind, because I guess they hadn't by this point, maybe once they had their title reign in 2007. But anyway, so Richards has a control segment, which I think isn't the fastest pace, but he does hit some cool moves, like big overhead belly-to-belly. And, you know, then Aries, you know, avoids a missile dropkick, gets his own little control sequence. And then late in the match, they kind of, like, Richards does the handspring kick. And that match always got a big pop. But this time it didn't. Like, people, I guess, were just over it. And also, this, again, kind of a weak crowd. At this point, Richard goes up to the top, and then Aries slaps him in the face to stop him. But Richards hits a tornado divorce court while on the top rope and locks on that bridging arm submission. And then they sort of have a kick fest, and they trade clotheslines, and Richard goes for a clothesline. But Aries hits a crucifix bomb and then immediately locks in the Rings of Saturn, which I thought was very cool. They continue to exchange strikes, and Aries flips through a German suplex, lands on his feet, and hits the brainbuster, and the crowd gets really into that as a near fall. And then he goes up for the 450. Richards moves and sends Aries shoulder first into the post. He DDTs Aries and then locks in that key lock, and Aries taps out. So, you know, maybe if Aries worked the arm a little bit more overtly, I think that might have improved things, but I do like that the arm work played into the finish. And yeah, I enjoyed this more than I thought I would. I would say I don't know where I'd rank this as far as matches on the show. Maybe third, maybe fourth, but I liked a few of the matches. So I thought this had very good work. I just, you know, I wish the crowd was a little bit hotter for it.
Tim, what do you think? And I'll note, I was looking over some notes. Brian Alvarez in figure four, when he made a note of saying that Davey Richards had stated at some point that Austin, he viewed Austin Aries as his big brother in the business. So this was he had to beat his big brother. He you know, he's not like me where he likes cousins stacked on top of cousins. But what do you think of this battle of metaphorical brothers?
I agree with, like, the solid amount of what Matt was saying there, but I would also argue, and I would just probably say that I actually think this was the best match on the show. I just thought that, like, there was a lot of layered selling in there that I think that maybe I picked up on that Matt didn't, because I thought that Aries did a really good job of, like, constantly showing and hearkening back to the arm being, like, worked on, and then the way that it played into the finish I thought was done really well. This was when I talked earlier about, like, you know, the Generico and Gunnar Scott Brent Albright match, about being like a West Coast supremacist who would, like, you know, have my PWG kind of biased, and this was like the opposite thing. This was kind of an eye opener because, you know, you talked about Gabe saying, like, who are the legends of ROH? And to me, like, I always think of Davey as a legend of indie wrestling, especially when it comes to, like, PWG and then also ROH. I think of Davey as, like, a big fucking deal, right? But, again, that's, like, that my West Coast bias, because watching this match, I was just like, Austin Aries it was just such a better worker than Davey. I mean, He just honestly is. Like, I love Davey. He's physically impressive. But Austin Aries is so fucking smart. And the way that I talked about the selling, the way that he paced everything, the stuff that he did, like, even just the stupid stuff where they are doing, like, the back and forth, like, teasing each other by referencing each other's moves, Aries did better. Like, I just thought Aries was incredible here. The other thing that was incredible about Aries was his back knee. I thought that he was, like, he was on a really intense test cycle where, like, you could just see how fucking, and it's just, I talked about it earlier with, you know, with Roddy and Shingo, these, yeah, like, these small guys were just fucking gassed to the gills. Like, Aries is just, like, beyond the point of fucking being too gassed. But the idea that, like, he's such a smart worker. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, he had been like that for months. Like, ever since, it seemed like right around the time he probably got the call that he was going to go, TNA was going to have him back. Do you think the back knee here is bad? Like 6 or 8 shows earlier, it is, like, literally at one point, like, there's one show, I think it might have been the Kenta and the Tenta show. There was a show where it was painful for me to watch him bump because I felt bad for him because it was so inflamed looking.
Yeah, it's fucking brutal, man. And it's just to see a guy who is that athletic and that mentally talented. And then also, you know, again, I talked about it earlier, where, like, being talented as an artist does not make you intelligent or, you know, or someone that I should look to as a good person, because Austin Aries is an entirely gigantic piece of shit. But...
Well, you could also be intelligent, and you could also be intelligent and be at a gigantic piece of shit. That's possible.
It's true. That's true. Yeah, that's true. But he's very dumb. But, you know, okay. Either way, yes. Yeah. But, you know, my point, I agree, and you are correct. But yeah, he's such a piece of shit. But he was such a talented wrestler, and at his peak, he was probably one of the best wrestlers in the world. And his wrestling just comes across so smart. He's just, like, so psychologically sound. I adored this match. Everything from, like, the way that he, you know, delivered his quad kicks versus the way that Davey did them. I was just, like, watching Davey do quad kicks, and I was like, man, like, why are you being so intense and putting so much effort into these quad kicks that are getting no sold? Like, you're just making yourself look bad. Because you're so invested in it. And then the way that Ares did it, where he was like, he did Kawada kicks later on, but he was selling the arm so he couldn't hold the head, right? So it's like, oh my God, he's, like I said, the selling, the arm selling that I think maybe Matt didn't quite notice, like, kind of came up there. Because it's like, you know, he would have held the head and done the Kawada kicks, but he couldn't. And he, like, touched his head, but then he was, like, selling the arm. He's pinning it back like a wounded bird. And it's just like, and he's doing them light, and he's being dismissive. But the fact that they both were doing the same spot, but Davey was, like, trying to put everything into it and look as brutal as possible. But Ares was no-selling it. And then when Ares was doing the Kawada kicks, he was, like, selling his arm. And he was, like, kind of being passive, and he was kind of doing it. And then Davey also no-sold it. It really spoke to the difference between the level of, like, intellectual workers that they were. And watching this match, as I talked about, like, I'm, like, West Coast supremacy. Davey is my guy, you know? He's from the Pacific Northwest, but he's a PWG guy. And I want to be, like, I fucking am 100% Davey fan. But Ares was just such a smarter and better worker here that I'm just, like, God damn. And then talking about the legends of the history of the company, it's very funny. Matt, you mentioned it. But the idea that Ares is on the cusp of being a, you know, ROH legend. But the two legends that he talked about were Joe, or Punk, Loki, and Joe. Punk, or Joe, was the champion that Ares won the title from. And Punk was the champion that beat Ares for the title, but somehow their legends and Ares isn't. It was like very confusing to me when it comes to the pantheon of the history of the company. But yeah, it was interesting. And I do think that, like, even as you mentioned, like, where are the Briscoes in this? I think even to this day, maybe, probably not to this day, but up until the point that Gabe left ROH, I don't think that he would ever say that the Briscoes were at that level of, like, the legends of ROH, even though they were. Because even on this show, he did the trademark Gabe thing, which is that no one can follow the Briscoes, right? But I think that Gabe kind of wrote that off. It's like, no one can follow the Briscoes, but that's not because they're the best wrestlers in the company, even though they are. Like, the reason why no one can follow the Briscoes is because they're the best wrestlers in the entire fucking company. But Gabe never really understood that. He just knew, I can't put anything on after these guys because, like, you know, they do all this stuff. It's crazy and they do all this stuff. But he really didn't appreciate the fact that the reason why no one could follow them is because they were the best wrestlers in the company. And even at this point, in 2006, the Briscoes were... they were already the legendary top face of the company. And I know Samoa Joe with his title run and all that, it's really important. But, like, I don't necessarily think that you can separate the idea that even by, you know, 2006, that the Briscoes were part of what made Joe's title run legendary. And you cannot necessarily say that, like, Joe was this bigger, more important thing than the Briscoes. By 2006, the Briscoes were probably just as big and just as important to the history of ROH as Samoa Joe. Trevor, what did you think about this match?
I would disagree with that because I think Joe was the most important. I think one thing that kind of would change the perception of the Briscoes at this point, the one thing that they did not have at this point that a lot of the other guys mentioned did have, is that one long title run that was kind of the signature title run. You know, they had held the tag titles before, but, you know, I think ROH in the Gabe era was a promotion where kind of the title run was kind of the thing. It was like the, you know, Gabe booked it as the peak of your run usually. You know, Joe's run was his peak in a lot of ways, I would say. You know, yeah, Joe versus Kobashi is amazing afterwards, but really he did in a lot of ways peak with the title run. You know, Danielson, right, at this point was good, you know, at wrapping up his kind of peak run with, you know, with the title. And the one thing that Briscoes, and I think when you keep looking at, like, the reporting around this time, something Gabe kept saying to the newsletters over and over again was, the Briscoes are going to get a big run we're going to get a big push in 2007. And you see them finally get a big title run where I think he, in Gabe's mind, you're not you haven't peaked yet until I give you that big, long, uninterrupted, like, just carry this belt for as long as it feels hot run. And he was going to give it to them. But I would say I'm kind of in between you guys on this match. I think we all like it, but I do feel there's a definite story to this match and a vibe. There's also something I would say a little off about it. Like, part of it, I think, is just the crowd, who I felt like did not give this match. Maybe, like Matt, you point out, maybe I was over exaggerating, saying they were completely silent, but they really did not give this match a lot. It felt like when they did get reactions, it was almost like they had to work really hard to get reactions that were like a fraction of probably what they would have gotten on another night from a different crowd. But there is, you know, it's interesting in the sense of Davey, you know, gets criticized a lot for being a guy with no psychology. This match had some of the most, I would say, psychology and selling of any match on the show, because, you know, they do, and Matt, you covered a bunch of them, they do a bunch of like, I know your spot, you know my spot things. And I think Davey in general loved to do that, even when he was wrestling a guy for the first time. You know, Jimmy Rave's talked about it on podcasts, but like, on top of that, you get the arm work, and I agree with Tim. I thought the arm work was good. You know, it wasn't the most amazing ever, but I thought the arm work was good, and I really thought the whole match was, like, fairly good. Like, everything about it was fairly satisfying. If I'm looking for criticisms, I think it's a pretty back-and-forth match, and they tell a story in the back-and-forth, because whenever Davey's on control, he's going back to the arm, and they're doing all those, like, I've scouted spots. But I do think this is a match where the story of the match coming in is kind of, you know, the way Davey's promo frames and the booking is the idea that Davey's this underdog. He's still relatively new in Ring of Honor. Aries is this accomplished veteran that's held the world and the tag titles for long periods. And, you know, this is supposed to be like, this is Davey's biggest win in Ring of Honor thus far. And the way they work it, like, Davey feels like the equal of Aries before the match even ends, and he wins really definitively with this, making him tap out clean in the middle with a submission, where I feel like you could, instead of doing back and forth, they could have done a lot, basically everything they did in this match, but just had basically all of the Davey stuff front loaded, and then made it feel like Aries is making this big comeback, and then, you know, have it to be a more dramatic kind of, where instead, almost the way they worked it, it kind of felt like, it didn't feel like the big win for Davey that it should have been, because it felt so even, rather than having a momentum swing from one guy to the other and back. And it's one of those matches where I don't have a ton to say. Like, it was fairly good. It would not be my match of the night, but had a good amount of action. It was not like absolutely insane. I kind of feel the way Matt did, where it was like these kind of matches were Ring of Honor's bread and butter, and this wasn't kind of hitting quite as hard as some of those. But, you know, after the match, Aries lifts Richard's hand. They get a round of applause. So again, you know, this is another match kind of like the you could argue the Daniels in the Kings of Wrestling match, where they worked that match to try and really put over Seidel as another guy. You know, this is a match where they're trying to get Richards up to that level and kind of pass the torch to Aries, even though he's going to stick around. And then we go backstage. We find Lacey alone. She says Jimmy Jacobs has disappointed her yet again.
Sorry. Before you move to the promo, can I ask you guys one quick question? And this is, again, it's quick. I'm sorry. I know I'm dragging this out, but
it's okay.
On the last podcast, and maybe even the one before that, you guys kind of talked about Cornette leaving and feeling like a fresh kind of vibe on the promotion. And I think that did artificially kind of create this thing. But do you feel like this show and maybe the show before were kind of like the third act of ROH? Because it was like the original first act of ROH was like, you know, natural. And then the second act of ROH was the Jim Cornette phase that felt weird. And then now we're kind of like settling into the third act. And I do feel like Davey winning this match and like the moving forward from there. And we even like, it's weird because it feels like an afterthought and it's just kind of there. But the fact that El Generico is in the first match and then like the Generico and Steen tag team against the American Wolves is kind of part of the third act. But do you guys kind of see that this is like the third act of ROH in a weird way? It's like this weekend leads into what becomes the third act of, or the third turn of this company.
I would say we're in a weird, like, epilogue period. Like, it's post-Cornet, but we haven't totally shed it yet. I don't think the next act starts until Morishima wins the title, is actually how I would describe it. Like, I feel like Final Battle is sort of in its own world of, like, wrapping things up, not completely starting that much new that would, you know, carry the company in 2007, except for there's like a couple things, you know, like, well, I mean, we'll get to it when we review it, but like Larry Sweeney and stuff like that. But like, I feel like it's the fifth year festival and what comes after that really sets them up for their subsequent era.
Yeah, what I would say is I kind of split Ring of Honor, just the way I catalog things, more into like a little bit shorter era. So I wouldn't necessarily say third era, but the one thing I would say that you see on this double shot that you, I think you're referencing in some ways, is part of the Black Cloud was the Cornette thing, but it felt, for like a bunch of shows, it felt like everything was kind of building towards the end of this year, 2006. And a lot of things still were, like, we're still in the middle of the Danielson reign. We're, you know, we still got to wrap up some of the Homicide stuff and the Joe Danielson feud. But starting with this weekend, just because we're progressing time, we're starting to see a lot more things that are being planted that are going to be like really picked up on 2007. Like, we're seeing the start of the Jimmy Rave, Nigel McGuinness feud. We're seeing, you know, El Generico, who's going to become a much bigger part of the company in 2007. You know, we're seeing him trying to book certain people, you know, a little guys like Sydal and Richards, yeah, a little stronger. So it is kind of refreshing. That's just the sense where it feels like this cycle of Ring of Honor has been not hitting on all cylinders. It is refreshing just to get a reminder of, oh, these things are coming to an end, and some new stuff, whether it's all going to be good or not, is starting to be – they're starting to plan it. You can see it coming now. We're getting close enough to the end of the year that we can finally, like, see the end in sight. So, yeah, we go backstage to find Lacey alone. Jimmy Jacobs is disappointed her yet again. He's in the hospital right now getting stitches, but she could not care less. She asked Jimmy to do one thing, cripple BJ Whitmer, and he couldn't even do that. She says it's obvious to her that she's going to need someone a lot bigger, stronger, and smarter to get the job done right. And then Lacey says she also hasn't forgotten about Colt Cabana, says that what happened to Whitmer tonight is only a tenth of the pain Lacey's Angels will put Colt through. And then finally she ends by saying, well, she wonders why Daisy Hayes is sticking her nose in her business, saying, you know, I'm the greatest wrestler, women's wrestler in Ring of Honor. I'm going to put a beating on you if you try and stick your nose in my business one more time. So very similar to a lot of Lacey promos, just a lot of housekeeping and letting you know, hey, I've got all these irons in the fire still. And that brings us to the main event, the Falls Count Anywhere tag team.
Real quick, have you guys ever noticed that Lacey, her voice is similar to Sarah Silverman? Have you ever noticed that she sounds?
I have not thought of that, but I will definitely look for it now.
Yeah, listen, she sounds like Sarah Silverman. Anyways.
Falls Count Anywhere tag team elimination street fight. Homicide and Samoa Joe, scored to the ring by Julius Smokes, defeated the Briscoes, Jay and Mark, in 12 minutes, 43 seconds, when Joe and Homicide simultaneously pinned the Briscoes after a simultaneous muscle buster and cop killer. So I just want to note something. This is really funny. This is a match that is a Falls Count Anywhere match. That's a rematch of a non-Falls Count, a match that wasn't Falls Count Anywhere, and yet that match went outside the building, and this one never does. This is also an elimination match that might as well not have been an elimination match, because basically it all ends at once with – it's a technical double elimination, but basically it's one pin ends the match. And yet the match before, that's the rematch of – could have been an elimination match, because one guy actually gets written out of the match halfway through and doesn't come back. So they've added steps to this match that you could have applied to the previous match that this match doesn't really need as much. But with all that being said, Tim, what did you think of this as a main event? This is basically, in a lot of ways, the blow-off of the Briscoes Homicide Joe tag feud.
Well, all the stuff you just said there is like classic Cornette booking. That's why it's like weird that this is not a Cornette show, that he's gone. Because the idea that you build all of this stuff up, right, and you do all these teases, like you talked about, like they go outside of the ring, they have things that could be eliminations outside of the match, right? But then when you get to the main thing, none of that stuff matters. It's like, that's the point. You know, you tease it, and that's why you build to the gimmicks. But then the gimmicks don't necessarily need to pay that off, because that's not the fucking point. The point of the payoff is Mark Briscoe doing a shooting star press off of the fucking entrance truss, right? That's the payoff. The real payoff is doing the crazy ass high spots. Like I talked about, where I said, I think that at this point, already in 2006, the Briscoes are legendary ROH acts already. And then we're talking about, 2024. Unfortunately, with the passing of Jay, which is just one of the most depressing and sad things to think about. But we're talking about guys who had already solidified themselves as legendary acts in the history of this company 20 years ago, basically. The violence, the aggression, the brawling around, everything that they're doing here is fucking perfect. The dynamic between Homicide and Joe is so much fun. These guys are just like so interesting, with each other. They're friends who get along. They're buddies. It's just what you want to see. They are going to give each other a high five. The vibe between them is incredible, and then the way that the match is just like aggressive, violent. It's quick, but it's like the whole point of this show was the tag team title match. It's why it's called The Throne. It's why that's on the main event. That's why it's the longest match on the show, right? There's a ton of other stuff, but this is the main event. But I do think that if you're in the building, and Matt was in the building, so he can talk, he could probably speak to this, I don't think you would be like disappointed by this being the main event, because the violent, chaotic nature of the brawling around the ring really delivered for it. There's a post-match thing where it's like Gabe on commentary saying they won the feud. Like, we all hate that. None of us like that.
But Gabe's never going to stop doing that one. Yeah.
But there was a thing in the middle of the match when Joe got the hockey helmet and the hockey stick, and I don't think it ruined anything, but it did definitely not feel like Joe, right? Like, am I wrong that like Joe wearing a hockey helmet and hitting someone with a hockey stick to play up like this gimmick of like, oh, we're in the hockey arena, and he body checks Jay into the glass. It's like, it's neat and it's funny, but that's not Joe. Like, Joe, the character of Samoa Joe, doesn't play like putting on a hockey helmet and doing that stuff. And like Joe is cool, and he's so cool to the point where like Joe was one of the best world champions on one of the biggest companies in all of America just a couple weeks ago, where like this guy just has this vibe where you believe in him. But that was one of those moments where I'm just like, this is like a Joe not really understanding what Joe is. Like, that the hockey helmet thing it's just like he took a step beyond it, but he pulled it off because he's cool. There's a ton of interesting things. The stuff with J Train, Julius Smokes lighting up a blunt, and then they put the blunt out on him as part of the finish, I thought that was weird. I don't think this match needed that. Just because, if any of us on the call have a germs burn, I know me, but I don't know, Mark, or not Mark, Matt, maybe you have a germs burn. Anyways, you get burned by a blunt, it's not that big of a deal. So it was a weird part of the match. But anyways, that's it. I thought it was good. As I talked about, I understand the idea that like the Briscoes are the Briscoes. You can't really expect to be able to follow the Briscoes, because even as I said, this is not the best match on the show, but I would definitely not try to follow this shit. And that's kind of my thoughts.
This was my match of the night. I thought this was like four star flat. Great. It was all action. And yeah, I just had a lot of fun. To me, this match was just fun. Like, you know, you start with the Joe and Homicide elbow suicida Tope Canhilo in stereo, which we've seen them do before, but I still just love that just as much now. And then we get the Briscoes doing a double dive to the floor. Jay actually overshoots it enough that he hits the barricade in an ugly fashion. I think it's that spot where for the rest of the match, he has this really ugly gash / bruise. I can't tell because of 2006 video DVD video quality. But either way, you know, the Ring of Honor guardrails, I think, claimed another victim. And so this is a tornado tag. And the opening part of it is like what I described. And it's usually two guys in the ring double teaming one guy in the ring. And it keeps alternating who that guy getting double teamed is. And it's fun and it's fast paced. But when the match really gets going for me is when it spills into the crowd and goes around the arena. Like, I want a match like this to be chaotic and crazy. And it starts to get to be at that point. You know, like Mark gets giant swinged into chairs. And Tim, I get why you would think that Joe putting on the hockey helmet and cross-checking with a goalie stick, which not good hockey form. A goalie would never cross-check. He cross-checks Jay into the boards of the hockey rink. Like, I get why you would think that's too cartoonish. As a Canadian, I am legally obligated to love those spots. The only thing I would have loved more is if he put someone into the penalty box. And then you get the biggest spot in the match, which is, you know... Yeah. You the greatest spot of the match was the shooting star press, like you mentioned. And it's one of those, it's Ring of Honor, like whenever they have a great camera shot, you know, Ring of Honor was not an artsy company. I always feel like it must have been by accident. There is a great camera shot here where you see Joe's going for the Ole kick on Jay, and you can see Mark in the background, who's been gone from the match for a while. Wow, ever since he took the giant swing into the chairs, climbing and walking top of the rickety thin ROH like entrance scaffolding. And you can just see it in the background, and no one else can, like the wrestlers aren't aware of it, but you, the fan, can see it, and you're going, oh shit. And you can perceive him like crawling and then walking along it, and then he does the shooting star press off of it. And I feel like the Mark doing the shooting star press off the ring truck in the last match these two teams had, that's the spot that's more memorable, because just the visual of a ring truck is more rare. But to me, this is the more impressive spot because it's way less footing. Like a ring truck, the flatbed of it gives you a ton of footing. This was very little, and he's like walking and crawling along of it, and I would have had no faith in that thing holding me up. And then from there, the match goes back to the ring for the final minutes. It loses a little bit of pace, but not a ton. Joe looks exhausted at this point. Smokes then, yeah, the weird thing is Smokes like lighting the blunt, and at first you, the home viewer, and I think the announcers too, are like, why? Because he's lighting it up at a point where his team is getting like their asses kicked, and you're like, why is he like lighting up a smoke at this point? And then you see, okay, he's going to burn, he's heading to Homicide so he can burn Mark. And then you get the finish. And to me, yeah, I thought this was just very, you know, 12 minutes. It's a very tight 12 minutes. There's some really memorable, like showy spots, but it's just action from beginning to end. I thought everyone worked hard here. I thought this feud in some ways was the one real bright spot of an otherwise pretty horrible last few months of a Cornette and his posse versus Homicide feud. I think if that feud gave us one like good thing, it was the tag matches these two teams had. And yeah, I enjoyed it. You know, again, it was by a little bit my match of the night. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I don't think it was my match of the night, but I will say, like, to go back to what Tim was saying, this actually was a lot better on video than it was live. You know, mainly because, I mean, you know, I'm sure you've been at matches like this, Tim, where like there's, you know, brawling around the crowd. Depending on where you are, you just can't see a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, and so.
It sucks.
So that was the issue. I mean, like, it definitely had a fun vibe. But, like, yeah, I mean, the fun of the match was stuff, a lot of stuff that I couldn't see, you know, whether it was the giant swing into the chairs and, like, you know, stuff like that. And just, like, you know, obviously I saw the dive that Mark did, but I didn't see, like, the ole ole kick set up that, like, he did it right at. You know what I mean? Like, that made it cooler. So, you know, the shooting star press off the entrance, I meant. The cigar thing. Yeah, I have not had a burn from that. Actually, you know what I'm thinking? When I was a kid, I was on a day camp trip to Sesame Place in Pennsylvania, and I must have been like 1993 or 94. And I remember I was just like walking by and somebody there had a lit cigarette and like just like not on purpose, just like my hand brushed into it. I was like, wow, that like hurt a lot more than I expected. But yeah, it didn't like leave any damage or anything. But I was like, oh yeah, that's fire that my hand just touched. Like, so that's the closest thing I ever had to a burn like that. But yeah, I thought that, you know, again, Mark was the standout, as he always is. I did think that it was silly to do the elimination match where they both get eliminated at the same time. But yeah. I do like the fact that this was like a brawling version of a sprint. And I liked that they kept it short, because that's rare for a Ring of Honor main event. And I think that made the match better, as opposed to trying to drag it out. Just like do everything you can and just kind of end it, you know, pretty quickly. Don't overstay your welcome. It's actually, I'd say, Trevor, you liked both of the big brawling Homicide and Joe versus Briscoe's matches that little more than I did, but I still liked this a good deal. I just wouldn't call this my match of the night.
So after the match, we get a great shot of Smoke's smoldering cigar on the ring apron. So again, another great camera shot for Ring of Honor on this night. Homicide grabs the mic, says he's going to be the next world champ at Final Battle. And then Joe snatches the mic from him and says, at Final Battle, we will be having a party, because I guess Homicide alluded to that. Homicide then mimes smoking a joint, which gets some laughs from the crowd. But Joe says, at Final Battle, Homicide will be facing him, not Danielson. Joe walks away to a chant as Homicide smiles. He takes it in good humor, for especially by Homicide standards, and he ends up just celebrating with Smokes in the ring.
I expected it to like break down into something there, because the commentary was putting it over that it was like, well, Homicide might have to wrestle Joe, and then Joe referenced it there, and I thought like that they would get into a fight, you know, but they did not.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't play it up as like, oh, this is tension against a new friends. It's just more like Homicide just rolls with like, okay, maybe it will be that way. You know, maybe we will have to face each other. But we end with more rare for ROH instant replays. We get two of Mark's walking, crawling across the scaffold into the shooting star press. And then we get one of the demo finisher to end the match. And that was dethroned. And that means it's time, Matt, for the Matt F. Trophy.
Whoa. But before we do that, we do, you know, the double finish, because some people on this call were calling it, you know, by its, you know, illegal name, but it was Homicide hitting the probation driver. Yeah, it was not the other thing. And as Homicide is on the apron, the last thing that you see, not the apron, but on the entryway as he's leaving, Homicide looks in the camera and he says, "Hola, Maricón. 23rd Final Battle," you know, and I just, why did Homicide have to say Marty Cohn? Because that is basically, you know, that's Spanish language version of saying the F slur. And it's just, he's already done a ton of stuff.
He's actually said the F slur in English at different points. Yeah. This is 2006 Ring of Honor. Unfortunately, we've become numb to it. That's just
numb to the fact that
I will also just say, I think, you know, when they were teasing Homicide, you know, possibly wrestling Joe at Final Battle, I think that was sort of like a legit like possibility, because they were still always telling Danielson, like, you know, if you want to lose this belt, like, you know, we'll let you lose it to Joe. Yeah. Like, you know, but the ironic part is Joe was the one who ended up being too injured to wrestle at Final Battle, not Danielson.
Yeah.
But anyway, Matt F. Trophy, for a first time ever, is going to go to an announcer. It's going to Gabe Sapolsky, because he said so many more interesting things and like weird things on commentary than we've heard in a while. And it gave us so many different tangents that we could go on to talk about. So I think Gabe absolutely deserves the Matt F. Trophy for the first time, and hopefully not the last.
I love that the first time Gabe ever wins it is for his announcing.
Yeah, exactly. Where,
again, through the years, continues to be the number one and number two appreciators of Gabe Sapolsky announcing compared to the vast majority of wrestling fans who have ever heard it.
I'm number one, right?
Yes, I would say. As
well, thank you, Matt.
Like, I'm number two. Dan, what did you think about the show?
That? Well, okay. It plays into what I thought about the show, and I really do appreciate you, Matt, giving the trophy to Gabe for his announcing on here, because it was one thing that was like the overall picture. It probably would have been my thing remembering the show. It works into this because I just recently heard, I think it was a podcast that was talking about Triple Mania having Larry Dallas on commentary, and they were like kind of talking about Larry Dallas like slipping, how often he slips into the cheesy announcer voice, right? And he's doing the, like, I always think of it as like baseball announcer, like radio baseball announcer. He's like, and it's a high pop fly, and it's going all the way out there into left field. You know that voice? You know what I'm talking about? And they were talking about like people slipping into that. And one thing that really hit me watching this show was that both Dave Prazak and Gabe Sapolsky, they are doing like announcer voice, like cheesy old school radio announcer voice the whole fucking time. And it's just, it's how different wrestling is now compared to here. And maybe you guys don't pick it up because you're just like watching this and it's normal for you. But like, announcer commentary voice used to be really cheesy. Like, this was like, this is, they are doing like, they are really trying. And Dave Prazak used to do that. He still does it a lot, but it's like, they are doing like baseball radio announcer cheesy voice. And that's like my biggest takeaway from the show. My other obviously biggest takeaway from the show is the stuff we've been talking about, where this feels like the third turn of ROH, blah, 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 whatever. But my biggest takeaway from jumping back into just 2006 is that, like, we used to be, like, this was how, like, radio announcers talked. This was how, like, commentary on wrestling, this is, like, normal. And it's just, it's, like, it's not like this anymore.
We're the worst for it. I think something, it's something Matt and I did notice way back in the day, because I think for people, if you go back and listen to, like, the first one or two shows Gabe announced with, Doug Gentry. He's much more laid back and just conversational voice. It's like two friends just watching a show together. And I think Gabe, you can tell like Gabe took the early criticism to heart, and his solution to that was, I've got to amp up the energy and really do the announcer voice. And likewise, I think Prazak, for some reason, like, his voice was different on non-Ring of Honor shows for a while. Like, you know, again, IWA Mid-South, promotions like that, he was a more laid back at times, and Ring of Honor was a much more official kind of voice, where, you know, a little more stilted, a little more energetic, but kind of forced energetic. So yeah, I would say about the show, it's a good show. It's not a great show. I think I'm kind of starved for even a good show. There's things I didn't like on the show as much as you guys, but things I liked a little bit more. But I think the tag matches, you know, I think we got a great tag match and a very good tag match. I thought the BJ and Jimmy brawl was really fun. You know, there's some stuff that's just decently good. There's nothing that was really terrible on this show. Again, it was like we talked about a little earlier, it feels like you're starting to see a couple seeds being planted for what's going to happen beyond the end of this year, which kind of gives it a bit more of a, you know, starting to feel like things are starting up a little bit, just a tiny bit. We're not going to get all the way until we get into, I think, more of the period Matt talked about, where like Morishima comes in. But overall, you know, it's a bright spot, you know, not a great show, but I would call this a bright spot in kind of a dim time for the company. Matt, how about you?
Yeah, I think that like, we're still in like a hangover period where like the booking isn't totally clicking, and so things aren't that over. But as a show of like matches, other than like kind of a weak start, I thought this show had a lot of good matches, so, and a lot of very good matches, I would say. And you know, I mean, that's what you want from an ROH show. And so I think this is definitely one of the better shows in a while. And you know, I think a good sign for where things are going. I'm very curious to see how the Chicago Spectacular holds up, because my recollection is that Chicago Spectacular 1 was so-so, and Chicago Spectacular 2 was very good. So I'm hoping that I'm right about that.
Well, let's get to some plugs. Tim, what would you like to plug? Anything at all?
violentpeople.co, the website. I think that's the website, violentpeople.co. You can follow them on Twitter at violent_people on Twitter. That's it. That's like the main thing. You know, I do a podcast on there. People have talked about it on here, on this very podcast. We've talked about it. But I would definitely recommend people check out violentpeople.co. That's the main thing. Anyway, that's it. So, and I had a great time. And, you know, people say don't meet your heroes. But for me personally, I think it was a pleasant experience meeting my heroes, Trevor and Matt.
We've been on your show before. You've met us before. Both of us individually, you have met before.
And the only thing that I have anything to do with as far as being heroes is that I, in New York City, we call sub sandwiches heroes, and I eat them sometimes, and that's about the closest I've ever been. But thank you, Tim. It was wonderful to have you as well. You added a lot, and I think, you know, you kind of shook us up in terms of, like, out of our comfort zone of things that, you know, we've sort of taken for granted just by watching so much ROH. That's like, oh, no, this is actually interesting, and we could actually talk about this.
So for our plugs, throughtheyears@gmail.com is the email, THROH for through. You know, you have any comments about a show you attended, you just want to reach out to us. If you want to have a suggestion for why a laptop I've owned for 1 year, the touchpad now randomly stops working, and the only thing that fixes it if I turn off the laptop for like half an hour and then start, and then it works for a day and then it doesn't work again. If you have a solution to that, email throughtheyears@gmail.com. At Trevor Dame at Twitter, at Mayor MGF on Twitter. You have a recipe for cornbread that isn't too gritty because mine doesn't come out right. There are a lot of things you could email us about. Those are just some of them.
Okay, Trevor, you have to melt the butter first. Are you melting your butter before you mix it in?
I'm melting so much. I'm doing so goddamn much.
Wicked Witch of the East over here in the West. Who's the one that says I'm melting? Which one? Is it the East or the West?
I'm melting. Yeah. It's the Wicked Witch of the West. Yeah.
Okay, yes.
So next time on the show, as Matt alluded to, we will be covering the first half of a Chicago double shot, the Chicago Spectacular Night 1. Here's what I remember about the show, Matt. It is Samoa Joe versus Brian Danielson in a steel cage, and it is a show that Gabe Sapolsky hated so much he rebooked Night 2 on the fly. So that bodes well, and we'll be covering it on the next Through the Years as we continue the march to the end of 2006. So until next time, have a good time. Have a great time.